Interim Senate Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness will come to order. Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I always like to talk about our soldiers after they come home or while they're over there. And the reading I'm going to do today, it's from the book that maybe many of you have written. It's called Exit Wounds by Derek McGinnis. It's a survival guide to pain management for returning veterans and their families. And I don't want to start out with a gruesome, but I think there's a reality check when we need to We are so much involved in policy and emergency preparedness, et cetera, we forget about what some of our soldiers are really going through and our veterans. So I'm just summarizing this one chapter, and it's titled Coming Home in Pain. And there is a price of survival. There is a price of survival. And here are some of the things that can make reentry to civilian life challenging, no matter what level of pain you may be suffering, and I'll just list them. One is you've changed. You as a soldier have changed. A second one is the loved ones have changed. Many servicemen and women are separated from their loved ones for long periods of time, and so your loved ones have changed. Another third one is you're severely wounded. And you could go into a lot of different wounds that soldiers have experienced. And the next one is civilians can't understand. War strips away many layers of culture and personality. And warriors live at the most primal level of human existence, where it is kill or be killed. And then the last one is you miss the close contact with your friends. There are bonds of friendship formed in war that are really difficult to duplicate. So those are just some of the words I wanted to share about our wonderful soldiers serving now and our veterans that are here at home. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Colleagues, and for those that are on the video cameras out in the public world, we're going to basically go down the agenda as posted. There'll be a task force report from Dr. Ashford if he's here. Then we're going to move on to the new Adjutant General, I guess 90 days Adjutant General, General Hokanson, and then a suicide data report, resilience response report, some PSAP information, and then actually kind of moving into topics for next January, because for those of you who don't know, we did Veterans Administration, Veterans Issues from the Department of Veterans last quarter. This quarter is the Military Department, and then next quarter is some of the bills and things like that. So we'll be hearing about cows. Cows are not things that run around in the field. For those of you out in the public, cows are cells on wheels. It's a communications mechanism, and that's what we'll wrap up with. And it is an informational meeting only today, so there's no real formal business other than the informational stuff and reports from everybody across the board. Is Dr. Ashford in the room? Okay. Dr. Ashford will be moved to the bottom of the calendar, and we're actually going to open up with an introduction of the new Adjutant General, if you'd like to join us. And we're pretty informal here, even though you guys are all in uniform.
Oh, no. Pretty impressive.
And since it's your first time, I only give minor instructions. All you have to do is introduce yourself by name, because we're as you see, we have the blue light special here, and everything is recorded and on videotape. So as each of you begin, just introduce yourself, and we'll go on from there. And you have the floor. Actually, you have the floor for quite a while. When you're completed, sir, you can kind of go on to suicide data and resilience or however you want to do it. It's your show.
Yes, sir. For the record, Major General Dan Hokanson, the Adjutant General for the Oregon National Guard. Good morning, Chairman Boquist, committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to meet with you this morning to discuss our suicide prevention efforts in the Oregon National Guard. And as you can see by the room, this is very important to us. I'd like to give a few brief remarks before introducing our subject matter experts who will be presenting today. With the mission of providing the state of Oregon and the United States with a ready force of citizen soldiers, airmen, and civilians trained and equipped to respond to any contingency, both natural or man-made, we strive to be transparent and ensure we do all we can to the best of our abilities with the resources we have to support the citizens of our state and nation and to care for our soldiers, airmen, and their families. This intent is reflected in two of our top priorities, one being to sustain the Oregon National Guard community and another to be good stewards of our resources. As a bottom line up front, suicide prevention is one of our highest priorities, and our efforts and resources are focused on key factors related to suicides, namely relationship stress, employment stress, family stress, legal issues, and feelings of shame or guilt. A few examples of our ongoing efforts include: every National Guardsman is scheduled for a minimum of 4 hours of suicide awareness training annually. We exceed the number of recommended Master Resilience Trainers and Resilience Training Assistants and have 684 personnel with advanced training in resiliency and suicide prevention in our ranks. We are using our federal and state resources on aggressive, multifaceted programs that include suicide prevention and resilience, behavioral health, service member and family support, chaplain assistance, legal assistance, and the Oregon Military Assistance Helpline. When looking at the issue of suicide, I often ask myself and leaders at every level, what more can we do to eliminate or reduce suicides in our organization? 11 suicides over the past 4 years is something none of us want to accept. As tragic as that number is, however, we must not forget that 96 personnel had suicidal ideations during the same time frame, and we were able to intervene and provide the help and services they needed. One example of our efforts occurred last month and was identified on a situation report. I'll abbreviate the report to lines number 4 and 5, which are most applicable. Line number 4 is the incident overview, and it states, a 142nd Maintenance Squadron was notified of a service member with suicidal ideation. The unit first sergeant made immediate contact with a service member, drove to his house, and spent the evening with him. Line 5 lists the actions taken, and it reads, first sergeant remained in contact with a service member throughout the day on 29 October. When it became apparent the service member was becoming more despondent, First Sergeant contacted the Wing Director of Psychological Health, who recommended immediate professional help. First Sergeant drove to the service member's house and escorted him to the emergency room, where he was admitted and remained overnight for observation and treatment. The First Sergeant in this report is Master Sergeant Ricky Bigelow, an Oregon Air Guardsman, who was also recognized earlier this year for providing first aid and rescue efforts to victims of a vehicle accident. He is just one example of how a battle buddy or wingman is making a difference every day in our organization. When I assumed duties as the Adjutant General, I asked for a review of every suicide in the past 12 months to see if there was a common thread and if there was more we could be doing. My review, and from what I have read and understand of those who study this full-time, is there is not a single fix, but rather multiple issues with opportunities we must address. We must help our soldiers and airmen identify the warning signs and behavior and understand the services available to them and how to access them so they can reach out to those ready to help them. We must also, whenever possible, assist families and friends in recognizing signs of potential concern and who they can contact to get their service member or family member the help or services they may need. While visiting all of our facilities in my first 60 days, one of the many things I looked for included suicide prevention, sexual assault and sexual harassment prevention, equal opportunity, and family support resource references. Although resident on the unit bulletin boards, I directed the development of a poster to be placed on the front of every readiness center with local or toll-free numbers and the website of these critically important services. This is just one more step in the process, but the reduction of suicides in the Oregon National Guard is a process we are fully committed to. This morning, I'm accompanied by 7 of my colleagues who are subject matter experts on our suicide prevention programs. In the order of their presentations, they are Colonel Leah Sandquist, our Human Resources Officer, who will cover the Army National Guard programs, Brigadier General Mike Stenzel, the Commander of the Oregon Air National Guard, who will cover the Air National Guard programs, Dr. Deanne Smetana, a Director of Psychological Health, and Dr. James Sardo, a psychologist who's also a clinical officer. They'll present suicides in Oregon. They'll be followed by Colonel Terry Larkin from our Service Member and Family Support Programs, and Ms. Michelle Kachowski, who's our full-time Family Support Coordinator. They'll talk about our service programs and what we have for the family members. And then lastly, it'll be followed by Dr. Julie Marshall, the Vice President for Clinical and Operational Services for Cascade Centers, will cover the Oregon Military Assistance Helpline. I'd like to thank you again for this opportunity, for your support of our efforts, and I hope you have time to visit our displays here in the Capitol on many of the programs we will cover here today. I'll be followed by Leah Sundquist, and we welcome your questions throughout our presentation. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Colonel Leah Sundquist, Deputy Chief of Staff, Personnel for the Army National Guard.
Let's see if I can get this to work. There we go.
This is our soldier and family support section. Please note that the assistant coordinator and program coordinator are new positions that have just been funded this month. All the positions are federally funded, as well as the master resilience trainers that we bring on when we need to have them in order to support or to provide the training that we do. The traditional soldiers are the ones that are in yellow. Those individuals are help do training during our 48 UTAs and or during the annual training 15 days that we have during the summertime. Right now we're at 96% on our MRT, which is a huge increase in this last fiscal year, and on our assist trainers we're at about a 570 increase. We've done a pretty good job in the last fiscal year.
Let's see, it's going backwards.
There we go. The program definitions are here with suicide prevention, which is a four-hour class. That's a mandatory requirement, and it's required to be done annually. The other areas, the ACE is an actual card that the soldiers are given, and it's the Ask Your Buddy. We use this with our battle buddy. Ask Your Buddy, Care for Your Buddy, and Escort Your Buddy. We focus on the five dimensions in all these different areas, and the intent is to have a holistic fitness program that should build the resilience and enhance the performance of the soldiers and their families. The five dimensions that are targeted in these different classes are emotional, social, family, spiritual, and physical. This is the integrated list of where we actually have resiliency training for all of our service members. It's the goal of the campaign plan, the resiliency and readiness campaign, to integrate resilience into all of the training across the Army DoD-wide. Officer, warrant officer, enlisted, and then any of the combined leadership courses that the soldiers attend.
Question. The continuing ed here, most of these, a lot of these are residential courses or in the, I guess, regional training centers, whatever you call these things these days. However, considering the fact that we've been at war for a decade, what's the backlog for, I guess, both on the Air Guard and on the Army Guard side for enlisted and officer continuing education? Because I know, obviously, we've been going to war. War's been the primary focus, and now a decade later, we got to go back and catch up with this because active component is way behind on these.
We have some area of backlog. I'd have to get you the actual from our training officer section, the G3, to be able to provide you accurate data. I do know on the NCO side that our warrior leader course and some of our advanced leader courses are backlogged. On the officer side, the intermediate level education, they've actually been able to provide some officers credit for the time in which they were deployed as part of their ILE and their advanced operations course, but I'd have to get actual data percentages for you.
If you could just follow up on that.
We can.
Because it doesn't do any good. We see this on our side all the way across. Continuing education is good, but if you got a backlog and people aren't going, they aren't getting the instruction and they aren't getting the contacts, and right, everything is personnel related.
Yes.
So if the two buddies don't get along, it isn't going to happen. Likewise, if they actually don't attend the course. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Madam Vice Chair, question.
And just to follow up on the training, and I'm a nurse and chair of the healthcare committee, and we're so focused on evidence-based programs. And I don't know if the military uses actually proven evidence-based programs. So in your trainings, is it backed up by research that this is effective and can make a difference in a human's life?
There is some, and I do have two slides that will show you what the intent is of the resiliency program as we go through and execute the campaign plan.
Thank you.
The Ready and Resilient campaign aims to reduce or eliminate suicidal behaviors, sexual assault, harassment, bullying, hazing, substance abuse, domestic violence, and any stigma or barriers associated with seeking assistance by a soldier. Purpose is to establish an enduring culture change that integrates resilience into how we build, strengthen, maintain, and assess total fitness and individual performance and unit readiness. The resilience campaign is inclusive of the total Army, which is the active component, Army National Guard, and the U.S. Army Reserve. Soldiers, families, and Army civilians as well, with priorities directed at improving soldier resilience and unit readiness. And we do provide services to the reserves as well as just the Oregon National Guard here in the state. This is our Ready and Resilient campaign plan. And the slide, you might be able to see the slide. It should be pretty good. We do have a display out in the lobby of this as well. This is the concept of the operation. The campaign is to be executed in three phases with four lines of effort, and those four lines of effort are numbered there for you. The phase one is the immediate actions accomplished in the near term to reverse the negative trends and to reinforce current efforts at building on resiliency. Phase two is to change the force, encompass activities to change the process and systems to incorporate resiliency into all of our assessment for the holistic soldier. And then phase three is to sustain that, focusing on the efforts to ensure that there's a cultural change and that cultural change is enduring. The line of effort one is refining the policies and prioritizing resources, and that's to establish the enduring program. Line of effort two is build and maintain the ready and resilient soldiers, families, and Army civilians, and readiness of units. As a main effort of the campaign, the Army strengthens readiness and resilience in the soldiers. And the outcome of that is to make sure that resiliency is fully integrated into training and deployment requirements. Line of effort three is the support of the second one, the main effort, and that is the outcome is to increase leader and individual actions, resulting in increased incidents of positive behavior, reduced incidents of negative behavior, and improved individual resiliency. And then the final effort is to communicate that change through actions of leaders and developing soldiers from their initial training coming into the military all the way through to their integration during their time in service or in the National Guard. The end state for the campaign, as well as for the Adjutant General, is achieved when the Army's culture and the Oregon National Guard's culture has embraced resiliency as part of our profession and as a key and critical component to readiness. Leaders, soldiers' families, and Army civilians receive quality assistance through the coordinated efforts of Army programs and services, reinforcing a command climate of trust, mutual respect, and self-discipline. This is our Master Resilience Trainer slide. We currently have 47 in the state, and we have an additional 18 scheduled for FY14. As you can see, Oregon is green, and we also exceed the national requirement of having 65% or more fill, being at our 96% fill right now. This is our resilience training assistants that we have working out in the field. We have 234 assistants, and for this fiscal year, we have 108 seats scheduled for training, and we have an ability to flex to an increase of about 192. We also have have the ability to request additional seats as we need them. We're green in this area as well, and we also exceed the 65% required for fill. This will help answer one of the questions from earlier. In the military, it's been touted that a leader spends 90% of their time with 10% of their subordinates due to behavior challenges. The resilience program goal is to move the entire bell curve to the right, making service members with temporary or habitual challenges that would not be counted in percentages or standard deviations, but as outliers. This strengthens the unit's cohesiveness and readiness of the soldiers, of our citizen soldiers as well. Programs designed to ensure that the skill is down at the individual soldier level, as well as the battle buddy concept that I discussed earlier, and that we continue to apply this in the squads and sections of the company elements.
Question?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does that mean that maybe some will not be able to become resilient? I mean, I keep thinking with so many different humans that we react differently to different situations. So is that...
I'm not sure that I'd be able to say that they can't become resilient. The effort is to try to facilitate training them in order to give them a comprehensive total fitness, as in lifelong fitness, lifelong health.
Okay. I just know that like in the police force, they have psychological tests that are given because there are some that just are not police material.
I probably have to defer that to one of our medical officers to have that answered.
Let me follow up with that question.
Yes.
And you don't get to answer it.
Okay.
And I'm looking for two answers, I guess, from the Adjutant General and the Air Guard Commander here, because I think it's really the heart of the Vice Chair's question, and that is, you know, we've been at war more than a decade now, and when we started the war, at least in the legislature and reviewing suicide from 2005 forward, when the presiding officers appointed a joint committee first, is the initial response to suicide issues from 2005 forward was throw their ass out. That was the response. And if they reported it, there was retribution. And so now, I mean, what we're really saying here is resilience here. The question is there is some level from the Air Force active component side, because I'll give you an exit strategy, and from the active Army side, the question comes down is they're identified as having a challenge. You know, what is the policy on the Air Force now, and what is the policy on the Army and the active component side in terms of, first, we try to do training, we try to provide them help, and we've come a long ways, because I know guys, when I left the Army Reserve and assigned to an active component, we had people with prosthetic legs that were still on active duty and still serving. And that would have never happened a decade ago. So what is the level in both branches of service in terms of resilience in if the first sergeant goes and finds someone, what is the training, what is the medical help, what is the retention, and then what's the resilience point of when they're going out the door? And if they go out the door, what do we do when they go out the door? Am I making sense here, sir?
Mr. Chair, when I look at the overall policy, I know that throughout the service, they're really trying to provide the best help that they can for each and every soldier. They're also doing a lot better screening prior to bringing soldiers in, because they're finding they want to make sure that they don't bring issues with them into the service. That being said, when we have soldiers identified, we try to do everything we can within our means and our resources to try and bring them to a level to where they can continue to serve. If they can't continue to serve for various reasons, medical or otherwise, there's usually a medical evaluation board process that's fairly lengthy that goes through the medical community for them to determine the suitability of that soldier to stay within the service. And then a determination is made, and I know Dr. Sardo can probably speak with the specifics on this, but once it's determined that they would depart service, the intent is to have a handoff to the Veterans Affairs to continue to provide that service member the benefits and needs that they have to make sure that they go back to become a meaningful member of society.
Thank you. Chair Gardsack?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd agree with that completely. A mental assessment in conjunction with a medical review is made before all of our airmen deploy. I'll be summarizing some of the training in my remarks later. But even prior to return, and I unfortunately can give you a personal example, you're given a mental health assessment even before you leave the AOR and come back to the States.
You need to introduce yourself, she's telling me.
Oh, I'm sorry.
They don't know it
sure.
On tape.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Brigadier General Mike Stensel, Commander of the Oregon Air National Guard.
Thank you. So as example, General Stensel, I mean, just as a case study, mm-hmm. I mean, we heard an example from the Adjutant General. I mean, literally a decade ago, if someone went to the First Sergeant or the Master Sergeant, pardon me because I'm not, even though I knew something about joint, I've sure. Master, First Sergeant, I'm not sure, went to either the full-time Master Sergeant or the M-Day Master Sergeant or whatever, you know, a decade ago, they would have got him immediate help and then give him a bar to reenlist and send him packing. And I think what we're trying to drive at now is the cultural change in the last decade in the military, in which it sounds like, at least from the case study, that you try to get them help, you try to get them back into the system. Is that, am I assuming right?
Mr. Chair, you're absolutely right. We have a number of professionals that they can reach out to, as well as their coworkers. They can have confidential assessment made by professionals that are trained to make the opinion whether or not they need to relay that to command and whether or not it's actually a workforce issue. And then they are directed to more professional help depending on the level of their difficulty.
Thank you. Other questions? Please proceed. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, this is the resilience skills that we were discussing earlier. And the resilience skills is hands-on training and self-development tools that are taught to assist the soldiers in all aspects of life, not just in the military. And so the intent is, as Madam Vice Chair, you were talking, is to try to ensure that our soldiers are all within that average to high performers, but we continue to work with all of the soldiers in the organization. And we want to provide enhanced performance and increased resiliency in both individually and collectively for both their professional career as well as their personal lives. And so a lot of soldiers go through these training as a trainer, but when they go through as a trainer, they're also learning skills for themselves that they can use for professional development. It's an enduring program that promotes well-being, strength, and skills in advance of adverse actions or events that occur that will cause counterproductive behaviors. And so we want to help them in that decision-making process. I want to stress that resiliency is preventative and not reactionary in nature. It's not a single course event or a requirement. It's a culture, a climate of trust, mutual respect, and self-discipline. There's nothing that we do after a soldier has, or not something we do after a soldier has a negative psychological, physical, social, or professional outcome. We want to work on the front end in the prevention process of that. This is the Applied Suicide Intervention Training. It's a crisis intervention training program. It equips people to respond knowledgeably and competently to persons at risk of suicide. Participants learn and practice skills in identifying and responding to people at immediate risk of suicide, just as if we were looking at CPR skills that make physical first aid possible. Training in suicide intervention develops the skills used in suicide first aid. Skills training programs address caregiver attitudes towards suicide, since these personal elements affect willingness to help and the effectiveness of the help. Such programs also typically explore options for linking people to resources for ongoing help, which is what we do in our battle drill process. The intervention and awareness training programs are skill-based and provide a solid foundation for intervention and follow-up. These are the resources, prevention resources that we have available. We have a battle drill process that the soldiers have in their units, and it's an actual suicide ideation battle drill that helps the individual soldier as well as the unit leadership determine how to work with the individual who's in distress at the time. We have the serious incident report that comes from either an individual soldier, a caregiver, or someone out in the community that that has a soldier who is in distress at the time. That's reported to our Joint Operations Center 24/7, so we can react 24/7. We have the Military OneSource available for all the soldiers. We have the Cascade 1-800 number line. And then we're at an advantage in that our chaplains are actually working full-time, and so each of our brigade headquarters has a full-time chaplain available to them, as well as the chaplains that are working during the drill weekends, our traditional soldiers. And then we have our community support of 911, emergency room, and VA center assistance. This is an individual soldier tool that's available. It's an online self-development tool for soldiers, family members, and Army civilians. It starts as a survey, and it's confidential, and it provides you with results in psychological health based of the four dimensions of emotional, social, spiritual, and family. The soldiers go online. They take this assessment every year, and they can look to see where they've improved or where they may have areas that they need to focus on based on their previous assessment from year to year.
Mr. Chair.
I knew this was coming, Madam Vice Chair. Go ahead.
Don't you think that that soldiers are going to game the system to make sure that they come out across, they know what they should say?
Madam Vice Chair, I've actually taken this, and I didn't find a way, personally, I didn't find a way that I could game the system in the way that the questions were asked. It's possible, but I have soldiers that are working in my section who have done this from year to year for the last 3 years and have actually found where their areas have strengthened and where they need to focus based on the previous year's assessment. And then they've gone through classes and they've worked through those areas of focus and have been able to improve either on their physical fitness or on their mental well-being.
I'll just follow up on that. The three of you are officers. I'm sure I could get the E6 out in the hall and could tell me how to game the system. So, and that is the concern, you know, that I think we all have. And let me digress here, because why we're going through the slides and why we're all here is that the challenge that we face is that in Oregon, I mean, we have roughly 330,000 veterans. Getting them to report, getting them to speak truthfully or not say what they think we want to hear is a challenge. And what we face is you've got 6,000 Army Guard and 3,000 Air Guard, roughly, in that category right there, and we inherit those issues. So, and that's why the good news is, from the state's perspective, is you have the military who now is trying to take care of its own, both on the air side and the Army side, which are sometimes radically different. And so that's good, and that helps out. But if you, as I said before, 2005, you bumped somebody out because they were a suicide risk, we inherited them into our social system in the state of Oregon with the other 330,000 veterans, of which probably a third to half of those are eligible for federal benefits, but we don't get the federal benefits from the veteran side. We get it from the DHS side, and people like Chairman Monis Anderson has to deal with figuring out how we fund this. And we know, same way, you Section 8 somebody out for a sexual crime on either branch of the military, they drop them into the community. We have no notice to the community, unlike if it's a civilian crime, and then they're a perpetrator or they're a liability on the health side. And so it's great to have programs. The question is, do they work, and are the enlisted people? I mean, the Navy still has that manual from 1908, which says, you know, the non-commissioned officer enlisted sly and cunning and bear considerable watching. And I think most of you on the Army side recognize that, because I used to be in the old officers' meeting. And so I think the concern that comes out is, just because the feds have a program, is it working locally, and are we doing the things locally we need to do? And that's kind of the perspective we're looking
at this from is how can we help you do it better? Because if you don't do it right, we inherit it and kind of have to pay for it. And the self-assessments ones, we've not had good chances, not had good results on the state side, I know. Maybe you're better. Thank you.
Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to follow up on that, too. From the enlisted side down, which is the side I was on, I would ask the question, when they do this assessment, you guys, are you privy to it?
No, we're not. It's an actual confidential assessment that the soldier does online. It provides the results to the individual soldier, and then the idea is the soldier is going to work with either counselors or when we go through our annual PHAs to work towards improving those areas of focus.
The reason I asked that was because we in the lower class are figuring out many ways to scam the system. And it would be important to find out, you know, since you're not privy, I guess it answers my question, because this could impact their career. If negative information comes out, like the guy might have an alcohol problem, it could impact him throughout his entire military career. And so I would suggest that, you know, perhaps there is a way to get around the system so that it doesn't impact it. But since nobody else sees it, if it's only that specific individual, it sees how he's doing.
We do have substance abuse programs as well, and I actually have two new positions that will be coming online this year. We have our annual urinalysis tests that are completed. So we do have venues and training available for alcohol as well as substance abuse when we find that we have soldiers that are in need of those programs. I'll be having a prevention coordinator coming in as well as an individual to help us work on our unit risk inventories that are like the previous unit climate profiles that we used to do. Those will be individually confidential, but the total report will be provided to the commanders as well as the adjutant general to provide direction and way ahead in working to change the climate and the culture of the soldiers in the organizations as part of the resiliency readiness campaign.
Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
Since you opened the door on substance abuse, do any of your troops carry medical marijuana cards?
I can't
answer. It's going to be, you know, it's a wave that's coming our way, and it's discerning, and it makes great concern for me if this is, you know.
They're not enforcing federal law.
Yeah,
pardon?
Exactly.
Great question.
Senator Olson,
I'm on
the Army side. I'm not able to answer that question. I'd have to find out from our medical section if we do have soldiers that have those based on their medical condition. Typically, that's in the HIPAA area, so that's not divulged to us as an open in an open forum.
And it's against the law, Mr. Chair, in still the federal, although they're starting to change. So the VA system wouldn't be issuing any marijuana cards. They would be getting it from the private provider.
But I would follow up to both of us and Senator Olson that it's, I mean, the reality is the world's changing. That's the reality. So this is probably coming down the road, and I think here in Oregon, on the veteran side, there's a substantial amount of them. I would expect the law at some point is going to change. So, and the military will inherit it just like it's inherited a bunch of other social policies.
And just to follow up, we did pass our medical marijuana law here, and we had a number of veterans. And they brought in the veterans for political reasons because they knew that we would be more sympathetic to the veterans who are able to cope in society if they have the use of medical marijuana. So it's a very complex issue, and I know the military would have a strong stance.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I can tell you from the air side that as of today, it is not acceptable to use marijuana. It is tested for randomly and regularly. It is not accepted.
Good. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Pending any questions, I'll be followed by General Stencil for the Air National Guard.
Good morning. The Oregon Army and Air National Guard share much of our suicide resources. So in the interest of time, I'm only going going to briefly summarize some of our programs here on the Air National Guard side, some that are complementary to the programs described by Colonel Lundquist, but specific to the Oregon Air National Guard. Formal training requirements start when our airmen first enter the Air Force with an introductory course of basic training, where airmen receive a one-day class that lays the foundation for suicide prevention and resiliency training. Within the Oregon Air National Guard, we have our own Wingman Day, where we dedicate 4 hours of training to suicide prevention and resiliency training as well. This is typically coupled with an hour of mandatory computer-based training that is also required annually by the Air Force. In addition, our commanders take a specialized training course that focuses on the problem from a command perspective, assuring that they have awareness on all the resources and tools available to prevent, recognize, and address potential suicides among our airmen. Lastly, our first sergeants are a critical link between our commanders and their enlisted force, serving as the senior advisor to commanders on personnel issues within their units. As such, to assist in our prevention and identification efforts, they undergo specialized training as well. I would like to bring your attention back to the term wingman. It's their equivalent of an Army battle buddy. As a flying organization, it's a particularly well-suited moniker for the way we approach this and many other problems in the Air National Guard. Being a good wingman to your fellow airmen is not just a mantra, but part of our culture. As it applies to this issue, it symbolizes the supportive relationship we want our airmen to have with their fellow airmen in need. As you heard in General Hokanson's opening remarks, a good wingman has been trained to directly ask, care, and escort a fellow airman who may be in harm to themselves. On two occasions in my career alone, I've had the opportunity to provide assistance to a wingman taking care of a fellow airman. In addition to the previous training requirements, deploying members receive suicide prevention and resiliency training as part of their pre-deployment and post-deployment training. This training is comprised of targeted training specifically for the member, as well as training for the entire family through our Yellow Ribbon program. Day-to-day critical information is also visibly posted in the buildings of all of our units. This information includes phone numbers for the Oregon Military Assistance Hotline, information on the Sexual Harassment and Response Program, resources available through our family program coordinators, and phone numbers and website information for Military OneSource. As you can see from this slide, we have a number of federally funded personnel supporting total readiness and suicide prevention. Each wing has a psychological health counselor available to provide confidential patient support at any time. The wing family program coordinators provide counseling and access to everything from financial planning and relationship counseling to employment and daycare. As an example, during our recent national furlough, they provided interest-free loans to help our airmen with expenses that cannot be covered due to their lapse in pay. Lastly, each wing has an individual orchestrating our Yellow Ribbon efforts, focusing on providing deployment support for our airmen, soldiers, and their families. The number of support personnel and organizations attending these events are numerous. They include legal counselors, Family Readiness, WorkSource Oregon, employer support for the Guard and Reserve, Oregon Veterans Affairs Outreach, Military Life Consultants, TRICARE Insurance, and even personal financial counselors. Supplementing this staff are a dozen Army and Air Guard drill status chaplains and their assistants who are readily available to provide not just spiritual counseling, but to assist and provide a complete package of emotional counseling and support to our airmen as well. Chaplain Larkin will be going into more detail on that program later in this briefing. This concludes my remarks with regard to particulars for suicide prevention for the Oregon Air National Guard. Subject to your questions, I'll be followed by Dr. Smetana.
Before we change it, Senator Olson, you have a question?
Yes, I do. Thank you, General. What are the ramifications if an airman is determined to be possibly suicidal? What is the ramifications to his career, and how long do you work with him to make sure that he can get over the hump and back and be totally functional without any inherent problems in the future?
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson,
Typically, the way I would learn about these as commander is by a referral from a mental health professional. Sometimes, you know, you just heard me describe this wingman concept. We drive this point from our youngest one striper when he enters the Air Force to look out for his buddy. It's not just a co-worker, but to learn about the individual and get to know him. So that when you see any type of tendency or concerns that an individual may be thinking of doing harm to themselves, that they'll elevate it to the supervisor, they'll take it up directly with the individual first. But if that's not working, work it up the chain of command and refer them to a health professional. After that, I can't tell you specifically where that point is with regard to the individual, where it ultimately gets reported to command, where this individual is not fit to do day-to-day duty. And it's not because I don't want to. I just don't know where that professional threshold is. But I know that they've been trained to identify that and relay it to us in the event that they would need to be pulled out of their job, aren't in a position to function on a day-to-day basis and get more professional ongoing help.
Follow up?
I guess my concern is that A or 1, if you've got two buddies that are really close and the guy sees that potentially this person could be suicidal coming perhaps back from a war zone or whatever, wouldn't that close friend maybe hesitate a little bit because he knows the impact of what could happen to this person if it's determined that, you know, he has suicidal tendencies, because it could affect his career? And then secondly, that person that turns him in, or if he doesn't turn him in, what happens to his career if this happens? Is there any punitive action taken against him for not following up?
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, I would hope, based on the training that we've given them, that they aren't thinking about their career at that point, that they're just thinking about this individual's life. From the time I've been in, we preach our core values: integrity first, service before self, and excellence in all we do. And we drive the fact home to these individuals that it's that person's life that's at stake, and we'll worry about the job later. But they need to take care of themselves and their families, and hopefully they'll have that courage to confront the individual directly, and if they still aren't getting the message, to elevate it up. I can't give you a guarantee on that. I can only tell you that that is really at the heart of what we do, and that theme is pounded every day.
One more, sir. Follow up. I guess the doctors that'll follow you might be able to answer this question better, but do you have any specific cases that you know of that someone showed suicidal tendencies, was able to get the mental health that they need, and then reintegrated into the service and carried forward with a successful career?
Yes, sir. I have been exposed to it.
Good.
And Vice Chair, any other questions? Senator Cordy. Any questions? I guess we're changed panels.
Okay. Thank you.
No, I do have a question.
Good question, Senator Cordy.
You know, I'm the only non-veteran here in this committee, and because of medical reasons, and I was in the Marine Corps, I didn't make it. I'm fascinated. Is the military? I'm the oldest one in this room by far. When I grew up, you were a strong soldier, or you weren't. And if you weren't, you no longer were a soldier. And I'm curious, in listening to your testimonies, General Robertson, I guess I'll address this to you because you are West Point. Is the military changing? Because an individual can be a very strong soldier one day and a very weak soldier the next. And that meant, in my generation, you were a weak soldier. You were a coward. You basically could not be relied on. And you had to live with that the rest of your life, whether it was privately or publicly, and it was a terrible burden. I'm listening to your testimonies, and Senator Olson started down this path. I'm just curious. I mean, it's like an individual can earn the Medal of Honor one day, but they couldn't earn it the next day. There's been studies of that whatever happened on 70. Are you genuinely changing in terms of an individual's performance to recognize that people have bad days? There are weaknesses now, and therefore, rather than take their command away from them or you know, reduce them or whatever you do, that you, that there is in this human nature ability to perhaps through bringing in support, and we're talking about that, that they still can be relied upon to be a very good soldier. I thought what Senator Olson was going to do is to say, you do this, you're never going to fly a plane again. I mean, for example, I mean, is there something going on, or is it no? Because we never get to be, I've never been in your private rooms when you're really talking about whoever you're talking about, and you're showing the fact you're weak, the individual is weak, he cannot be relied upon, she cannot be relied upon as a soldier anymore. Because you are trained to go into combat. You are trained to put your lives on the line. You are trained to be under fire, whatever that may be, in a plane, on a ship, or on the ground. And people die, people get wounded, decisions have to be made, and they get tested mightily, and so you're constantly judging it. But is there something going on in the military where you're starting to take a second look that with the resources that you have, if we provide them, an individual still can be trusted tomorrow, even though today they had a weak day? That's a very general question. The last thing is, are you tougher on officers this way than you are enlisted men? Because officers are the ones that are giving the orders, and often in a very unilateral way. And again, I'm speaking very generically. It's not a fair question, but I am fascinated by what I think is going on. And I thought Senator Olson was moving in that direction. I think mental illness scares the hell out of people. Still does, and I would think it would do it in the services. Not to mention alcohol does it and other things. So I don't know if you chairs take a run at that, and I know you're right, there's words and there's numbers, but you are military. That's what you are. This is your career. You make judgments. You are officers. No matter how good you are at screening, men and women make mistakes. They show weakness. They cowardly. I mean, they can't go. What is happening really philosophically, if anything, outside of presentations, and I'm not trying to be disrespectful, numbers, asking for money to have centers to counsel people, what judgments really are still being made by officers and ranking people about people who show weakness, shall we just say, let's just use the word, because is it still viewed as weakness in a way that you can't go. I can't trust you in combat. I can't trust you in this airplane. I can't trust you in this critical situation. We'll deal with you in a special way or whatever. So I just found myself thinking about this because I'm so much older than all of you. It's happening in life, but is it really happening?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Courtney, sir, when I look back over the time, there has been a shift within the military. I think when you look at over the past 12 years of virtually every level where even what was traditionally considered rear echelon troops are in the thick of battle at any time, I see a fundamental change of not just either you can cut it or not, but understanding that there are different days, as you mentioned. One day you could win the Medal of Honor, one day you couldn't. But I think overall what we're trying to do as a military is to look at each other and realize we are going to make mistakes. None of us are perfect, but how can we take care of each other? And ultimately it comes down to just doing the right thing for our service members and getting them the help they need. Previously in my career, I don't think an officer would ever ask somebody, hey, you need to go see the chaplain, or hey, how are you doing? That is now really common practice among senior leaders, keeping an eye out for each other and saying, hey, do you need some help? Or hey, why don't you take a day off? You look really burned out. And I would say, in working with our state command sergeant major, Sergeant Major Lake, I know that he shows that same level, either officer or enlisted. And I would like to think that what we've learned over the past 12 years is all of us are going to face difficulties in one aspect or another of our lives, whether it be with your family, with employment, with relations, or even physical, that we have to address those. And when I go back to some of the statistics you'll see later, as I mentioned, is we've had 96 suicidal ideations. I couldn't tell you the name of any one of those soldiers or airmen. What we are most concerned about is can they perform their job? If they can't perform their job, too, do those, you know, outside influences on their lives, what can we physically do, or what can we do within the means and resources we have to address those so that we can bring them back as productive members of our organization? But in the end, sir, I think we've learned from possibly past mistakes, and we put a lot of resources to the things into the things that have occurred to our soldiers and airmen and Marines and Coast Guardsmen and Navy personnel over the past 12 years to try and identify those issues and fix them, because the last thing we want to do is have a problem that we just give back to society, because it doesn't do our country any good. It's best that we all try and resolve that situation where we can, so that we, when our service members leave the military service and become veterans, that they go back to be meaningful members of their community.
It is probably.
Well, that's fascinating. So you actually think about when they're going to leave that you have a responsibility. They still can live a productive life in terms of their family and their communities. That's also a part of what you're thinking. And that's one other thing. Don't take this wrong. Is this because you're following orders, or is there a real mindset change? I mean, that because, you know, well, we better do this, or we're going to be before a congressional committee, and there's always a state senator, a U.S. senator, a member of Congress that's going to blast us, or you're going to be in front of all these committees, or is there really a mindset that's taking place? And maybe it's generational. I don't mean to put you on the spot, General. I really don't. Maybe it's generational. Do you really, really think this, or you're being told to think this when it comes to human weakness and things? Sorry, because I won't ask any more questions, because I just define myself as the knowing non-veteran wondering about these things. So you will be patient with me, won't you, Chair? I'm old.
Mr. President, you're the balance on the committee.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Courtney, sir, I truly believe it's a mindset. I mean, I look at it this like, you know, I live in these communities. And one day I'm going to retire and I'm going to become a veteran. And I want to know that I did everything within my means when I had the ability to do it, to do everything we could for our service members. So when they went back, they became a continuing member of their society. Because even though someone leaves the service, they're always a veteran. And we're going to be one of those people one day, whether we want to or not. And so regardless, we need to do everything we can. And I truly believe it is a mindset. I have two sons in the military, and I want to make sure that I help set the priority and the standards so that we take care of every single one of them, because every single service member is somebody's son or daughter or father or mother. And if we don't take care of them, we just perpetuate the problem. And we want folks to look at those that we take care of and leave the military service and go, that's an organization I want to be part of, because that allows us to become a better organization.
Thank you, General. Thank you, Chair.
General Stencil, same question.
Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, I would echo General Hawkinson's comments. You talked about both weakness and trust in your question there. And I would characterize it more as a trust factor than a weakness issue. We look at that as trust within the Air Force. We are not a single mistake Air Force. That being said, it's important to have the trust of your peers and the trust of all of you and the citizens of Oregon and the United States. So there is a threshold where to maintain that trust internally and externally that you need to step in and do the right thing, if you will. But again, it comes from that more of a lens of trust than looking at an individual from a point of weakness, trying to do the right thing for them and their families and the organization.
Thank you. Right. Other questions? I think we're going to change panels, are we not? Or at least change a few seats.
Yeah. Yes, thank Mr. Chairman.
I think we're moving to psychologists, right? Shrinks?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
I would follow up, Adjutant General, just a point, which is the crux of Senator Olson and Senator Courtney's, and in frankly more blunt terms. And, you know, the whole notion, you know, are we doing a mindset change and are we changing, I think it's important, because, yeah, the reality is, whether these two to your right are going to agree or not, the fact is whether it's an Air Force, an Army Air Corps pilot bombing Dresden, or an Air Force pilot hitting a Taliban target, or one of your Guard soldiers defending, you know, a Kab in the middle of Afghanistan, this is a different, you know, anybody who tells you are sane for killing another man is nuts themselves. And we're in this business of which the fact is every member of the Air Guard and every member of the Army Guard, whether they're in direct combat or in support, at some point is supporting someone whose job is to go kill somebody else, which sane people don't kill, they'll kill people.
It's a necessity, but sane people don't do that. And so here we are in this deal where for 200 and some odd years, if you showed weakness or you showed mental instability, generally speaking, you got put out. And for once, probably, I think this is an anomaly in the history of America, for the last at least dozen years, we're addressing the fact that you have to help airmen, soldiers, Marines, sailors, so on and so forth. If you want these people today to go shoot somebody, tomorrow go give them food. There's a lot of quantum shifts here mentally. And our fear is, as the director of ODVA is back there, is you got 330,000 veterans in Oregon, vast majority are Vietnam era, and they didn't have that benefit. And so we are seeing in our social systems at DHS, in healthcare, in mental counseling, whether it's food stops, you pick the program, this growing group of these veterans who have not assimilated back into society when they ETS'd in 1969 or 1989. And that's what we face at our level. I mean, and so the question is you guys impact us, and we don't get to beat up the Federalists because we don't have any federal bases here. So you carry the brunt. So please proceed.
Sir, thank you.
Now you're going to tell you I'm insane because logical people do shoot people, right? So.
No. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I am Dr. Deanne Smetana, and I am the Director of Psychological Health for the Oregon National Guard. I hold one of two of these positions. I am a licensed mental health counselor in the state of Washington. I hold licensure in Oregon, and I also hold a national certification in counseling. The position that I hold today is that of a civilian contractor. I provide behavioral health services full-time to Oregon National Guard members. What I would like to do today is I would like to paint a portrait of what suicide looks like on a national and a state level. And then I'm going to hand it over to Dr. Sardo, who's going to begin speaking about what suicide and how it's impacting the Oregon National Guard and what we're doing about it. Before I do any of that, though, what I would like to do is first and foremost make the statement that I am a clinician. I work daily with service members who are struggling, with service members who are in need. I see the faces of, hear the voices, and feel the grief of those individuals who have experienced suicide or who have been close to it. I'm going to stand up here and I'm going to talk to you guys about numbers, about trends and statistics, but it's really important that we don't forget that these are actual people. They are the brothers of, the sisters of, the parents of, the children of our citizens. It is not lost on those of us who work in this field the tragedy that suicide is to anybody in our communities. It's a grief that people don't reconcile. Suicide is a different death for human beings than any other type of death. Okay, with that going forward, what I'd like to point out that we as a nation are struggling with suicide. In 2010, Oregon was 35% above the national average in suicide rates. Oregon currently this year is 8th in the nation. That is, the state of Oregon is 8th in the nation for suicide. We fluctuate between 10th and 8th place, but we are typically always in the top 10 in the nation. Okay. Again, the nation has a problem. Suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in the nation. It is right up there with heart attacks, heart disease, cancers, diabetes, and so forth. Suicide, Oregon suicide, is the second leading cause of death in our state for our young folks to age 10 through 24. There's a lot of speculation as to why this may be occurring or why this phenomenon is happening. We've got suicidologists studying suicide in major universities around the country trying to figure out what's going on. Some thoughts that are being thrown out are that there's been some major societal shifts, some changes in our parenting style. The phenomenon of everybody wins a trophy generation that's been going on for about the past 20 years, an increase in social media, perhaps the breakdown in the family system, and then there's a phenomenon that is not new, and that is that violence in the home. So children who are raised in violent homes are at higher risk of suicide than those children who are not. Regardless, the second leading cause of death for our young folks is suicide. Suicide claims more lives each year than homicide, HIV, and AIDS, as well as automobile accidents. So the likelihood of somebody dying from a suicide versus an automobile accident is higher. That's a surprising number to me. Interesting enough, 45% of all victims have seen their primary care physician before they have completed suicide, taken their life by their own hand. They're seeking solace. What this may tell us is they're seeking some type of relief from the fatigue and lack of energy that depression causes. They're seeking maybe as one last chance to help remedy their feelings, but what we do know is they are seeking care from primary care physicians. Some commonalities with national trends. Why is Oregon always in the top 10? What we do know is that there's not a lot of differences. We have more in common with the nation than we don't. The commonalities are that men are more likely to commit suicide than women. It tends to be more of a male issue or a male challenge. The reason for that is that men use more lethal means to kill themselves. Firearms is the number one method. Up there should also be suffocation, otherwise known as hanging, again, another lethal method. Women use poisoning, otherwise known as overdose. They say women make more attempts than men do, however, men are more successful. Youth and our elderly are more at risk. Ages 18 and 24 are at high risk of suicide. Again, that lack of coping skills for our younger folks. They haven't learned that they're going to make it through these bumps in the road yet. Emotional maturity is happening later than it was in previous generations. And our elderly over the age of 85 are at greater risk. Factors, that Oregon mirrors the nation is that 74% have been diagnosed with a mental health issue or a substance abuse issue. Mental illness and substance abuse are both difficult to live with. Relationships. People who commit suicide have relational problems. People who are driven in to see folks such as Dr. Sauter and myself typically have some type of relationship problem going on. They feel disenfranchised. They're disconnected. They're not getting along with their parents. They're arguing with their children, their bosses, their neighbors, what have you. Typically, there will be a relationship element. To the human condition, relationships are everything. And when people aren't thriving in their relationships, they begin to feel very poorly. There's also the financial issue, which is job loss and housing. People need to have their basic needs met, have a roof over their head, food on the table, so that they don't feel like they are burdensome. One will often hear that burden toned in somebody who is contemplating suicide. Legal issues are very frightening for people. And then lastly is health issues. People who are struggling with their health are not able to function like they once did, really struggle, again, with that burdened feeling. You're going to hear that theme throughout. And then moving on, what we do know, what we do see that might be contributing to Oregon's high suicide rate, and what is unique to Oregon, is that our unemployment rates are slightly higher than the nation's. We're at 8.1 to 8.8 for Oregon, although I heard this morning driving in it was at 7.3, yes. And it was the lowest it has been in the last 5 years. The national average is 7.3 to 8.1. Our income levels, we are lower in income than the nation. We are 9% lower in income levels than the national standard. We rank 33rd in the nation for income. Once somebody gets off of the I-5 corridor, we get outside of the Portland, Salem, Eugene area, we get relatively rural. We get rural. It's difficult to access mental health services in the rural areas. I can speak hand from experience. Trying to find a distressed patient or service member services is very difficult. Oftentimes we're asking them to drive several hours both directions to seek care for either counseling services or for medications management if that's deemed necessary. That's a lot to ask of an individual who's really struggling. They typically don't have the energy or the means to do so. And mental health expenditures. The state of Oregon spends approximately $157.08 on individuals who are 135% below the poverty level. Those would basically be, in essence, our Medicaid, Medicare patients. What that tells us is that Oregon is average in the nation for mental health expenditure. They're neither high nor are they low. Our neighbors to the east, Idaho, pay $33 for mental health expenditures on the same populations. They're last place. This gives us a barometer or a temperature for the way Oregon feels about mental health. They do acknowledge it. They do provide services, but again, they're neither high nor they're low. We fall average.
Mr. Chair.
I'd like to make a comment on your unemployment rate, and you're absolutely correct. It's one thing I've been harping on for 2.5 years is our employment rate. Yes, the employment rate has dropped, but our U6 number is still 16%, meaning those people that are underemployed or have quit looking is still relatively high, and I think that plays heavily on the problems we have in our state. I think it also impacts our income levels, because those people that have taken work in jobs that don't pay what they used to pay, it puts a lot of pressure on them. It's a tremendous amount of pressure on them to keep up the family lifestyle they had, and I think that's why we're below the national average, because we have such a high U6 number, and I'd like that on the record.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think I sent you that number this morning, right?
Yeah, you did.
And the key point that I think in mental health expenditures, and as you pointed out, that probably has an adverse impact, at least on the Army Guard, maybe not so much on the Air Guard, is the fact that you have more rural armories.
Yes.
And the U6 and the unemployment rates, of course, in rural counties are actually higher, much higher out there versus a lot of other areas.
Yeah. So. I would be remiss if I didn't mention the weather. Okay. People oftentimes place suicide, are high rates of suicide due to the weather. And what we're actually finding out is that may not be true. Oregon is in what we call Suicide Alley, which includes states like Alaska, but it's Montana, Wyoming, Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, and then Oregon. Excluded from that is Washington and California. The western U.S. has higher rates of suicide than the eastern half. And what the speculation is that those that are rural, low income, and have high access to firearms have higher rates of suicide than other parts of the country do. Going back to the weather, we know that Arizona and New Mexico have a greater number of sunnier days than we do here in Oregon. So it may not be the weather. It may not. We may not be able to place the blame at the weather's feet all the time. Washington, which is 12th in the nation for income level, is 24th for suicide. Their weather's not better than ours. It's just these are thoughts. We're looking for reasons as to why Oregon is so high, why we remain high. And again, just to wrap this up, this is a national issue. It's something that the entire nation is struggling with. It's number 10 in the nation for cause of death.
Doctor, you're not making the assertion that global warming has anything to do with suicide rate?
I can't speak to that, sir.
Okay, thank you.
I don't know.
Hey, an observation from the slides that we had earlier. Washington, I think, was at 46%, was either yellow or red in the resilience program, yet it's doing vastly better than we are. I'm just making an observation.
Outcome-based.
Guy, can I ask the question? We have assisted suicide in Oregon.
Yes.
Your figures, when you're talking about globally, is that you're including assisted suicide too?
Yes, and the numbers there are people who are 85 and older are a high risk of suicide, and I believe that accounts for those individuals.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm just a dumb infantry person. Are they numbers in or out? Is the assisted suicide numbers in those statistics or out of those statistics?
Those are Oregon numbers as a whole, and I believe they're included, but I can check. I'm not 100% sure.
Okay, thank you.
With that, if I could hand that over to Dr. Sardo to speak specifically about Oregon National Guard, he'll take over.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Major Jim Sardo. I'm a clinical psychologist with the Oregon Army National Guard. I work in the medical command. In the interest of complete disclosure, I'm also a program director for PTSD and substance abuse services for the Portland VA Medical Center. Well, I want to move forward from Dr. Smetana's remarks and bring to your attention kind of a fairly dense slide. It's a data-rich slide. This represents suicides by state and territory over a six-year period for the Army National Guard. These do not include our Air National Guard numbers. What I want to point out are three things. First, Oregon's high. We're in the highest quartile of these data. We have, when you look at it aggregated across the entire time frame, roughly about 3.2 suicides per 1,000 soldiers serving in the Oregon National Guard. To put that into perspective, if you look to our neighbors to the north who have roughly a similar size force in their National Guard, their numbers are essentially the same as us. When you look to some of the other states in the high the top 10 in terms of suicide rates outside of the National Guard, civilian suicides. We fall somewhere in the middle. We have states that have higher rates of suicide in their National Guard members and some with lower rates per soldier serving. The other thing I want to point out in this slide, and you read these slides, this particular slide, from the top down in terms of the colors on each bar, there are some very compelling recent data in the active duty that would suggest that suicide rates are coming down. The data set for the National Guard is not quite so compelling, though there is a suggestion that suicide rates are coming down. Certainly for Oregon, we haven't seen that drop yet, though if it's consistent with the rest of the country, we hope to see a similar response. This slide represents similar data over a 7-year time frame for our Air National Guard, our wingmen in the Air National Guard, and it's plotted against the total size force for each state. If you look, the thing that jumps out right away is that when you look at Air National Guard members, their likelihood of committing suicide per 1,000 airmen serving is lower. In the case of Oregon, it's about 1.5 soldiers per 1,000 serving. When you look, for example, at Washington to North, they have a smaller guard, but per 1,000 soldiers, it's 2. It's a little bit higher than ours. Across the country, you'll see that the rates are lower than the Army National Guard. There are a couple of things we think are going on there. One is when you look at the aviation branches, they tend to have a higher preponderance of officers. They tend to have higher education levels. Those are both protective factors when you look at the epidemiology of suicide, both in the civilian side and in the military. I want to drill down a little further and look at our Oregon Army National Guard soldiers by demographic. I want to point out as we look at this slide, this is a little bit smaller time window. This is a 3-year data set. What stands out here is that our citizen soldiers in the state of Oregon look like our citizens in the state of Oregon when it comes to suicide and suicidal events. That you have higher rates of death and suicidal ideation and suicide attempts amongst our male members than you do our female members. Though there's some unsettling data on the active duty side that our female soldiers in particular are starting to increase the lethality and would be more likely to use firearms than their predecessors were even a few years ago. You'll see that our younger soldiers are far more at risk for suicidal events of all types. You'll see that our enlisted soldiers are far more at risk than our officers. Finally, I think one of the things that stands out to me when I look at this slide is that, like any risk management data set, and I took a risk management training from NASA one time, they talk about the inverted pyramid, where at the very point of the pyramid is that sentinel event, that bad thing that happened, but above the pyramid as it gets broader and broader, there were plenty of data that suggested something was evident, something was observed that would have given us something to look for that might have predicted that this would happen. If you look at the long blue bar at the top and compare it, that says this suicidal ideation, someone was thinking about suicide, happened far more often than actual attempts or completed suicides. And that for us, in terms of those of us that work as clinicians, really reminds us that suicide is one of those preventable causes of death. One of the things we tell our soldiers, and this has changed obviously as the course of both wars that we've recently engaged in have moved forward. When I talk to a room full of 100 soldiers, statistically, when they look to their left or right, they are far more likely to be able to save the life of their fellow soldier or airman from suicide than they are from a combat death. We spend 4 hours required training. Oregon National Guard has kind of supplemented that at the guidance of our Adjutant General with additional training and intervention. But it still doesn't compare by orders of magnitude the amount of training they do for their combat tasks and drills. So we have a lot of road to cover yet, I think, in terms of how we think about suicide in the military. When we talk about who are these soldiers, who are these airmen, like our citizens in the state of Oregon, they tend to be male. They tend to be age 24 and under. Like their counterparts in law enforcement, they tend to be more likely to use firearms than the general citizenry of this state. Alcohol is suspected in the majority of the cases, if not overtly present and easily identifiable. In 50% of the cases, there's a diagnosis, a general mental health diagnosis, or a specific diagnosis of substance abuse, depressed mood. 50% of these folks were not in behavioral health services at the time of their death. Additional factors that seem to show up quite frequently, like our citizens, are relationship problems. National divorce rates, when you look across the country, run at about 40%. A great tragedy for the last 10 years is that divorce rates in the military have been running at 60%. And what stands out when you look at those numbers, they include the active duty, who are a population that have, by definition, full employment, full medical care, family support services, and all of those things that the national divorce rates don't include. So presumably you would expect there would be fewer pressures on the family. However, the pressures of serving in the military would seem to outweigh even the great interventions and supports we have. Our citizen soldiers, unfortunately, carry both burdens of being citizens and not having all of the day-to-day supports you find on an active duty base and the difficulties of having served in combat and continuing to serve in the military.
Mr. Chair. Doctor, could that be correlated to the fact that they've been deployed and redeployed so many times, the stress of separation and the stress of worry on the spouse's side of death or permanent injury to their spouse? Is that a contributing factor to why the military is higher in the last 10 years?
Hey, Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, that's certainly one of the factors that's been studied pretty extensively over the last at least 6 or 8 years. The data are not really clear, though, do suggest that that is one of the primary contributing factors. However, we do know when you look independent of deployment, the general high operational tempo that the military of all branches have been under supporting the current wars has tended to put a sufficient strain on the marriages and relationships to cause divorce rates to be high in both populations.
Thank you.
Financial problems are also very prevalent in all of our suicide events, whether it's ideation attempts or completed suicides, and legal problems. As Dr. Smetana mentioned, for our younger service members who are contemplating suicide or who take their own lives, they tend to look at the future in absolute terms, and a legal problem is something that's relatively permanent. They don't tend to think beyond that their life might change. And commonly when we do psychological autopsies and we look at what was present, someone may have had a recent legal stressor or change in their legal status. The lineup we bring in the state of Oregon is rich. I have had the opportunity to work in a deployed setting with National Guards from multiple states. I continue to be impressed by the tremendous support we've enjoyed in behavioral health from the Adjutant General's office. We have currently 5 drill status soldiers that are providers. We have 2 doctoral level providers and 3 social workers. Come January, we're adding an additional doctoral level provider, an additional social worker. This will put us at 200% of our assigned slots for behavioral health. I have not run across another state that has had that kind of support from the Adjutant General or their state surgeon. We are partnered with our civilian counterparts, such as Dr. Smetana, who have been a tremendous support and have bolstered our mission effectiveness in ways I can't even begin to describe in the time we have here. We have 4 directors of psychological health, 2 working with our Army soldiers and 2 with our Air National Guard force. We have a doctoral level provider and 3 social workers. We have 3 marriage and family life consultants, comprised of 2 social workers and 1 financial consultant. I want to draw back to the previous slide. Marriage and family life consultants and a financial consultant dovetail quite appropriately with financial and relationship problems, which are high predictors for suicidal events and completed suicides.
Well, Doc, anybody that's been married knows that finance and wives and husbands are a big topic, okay? So.
Military or not.
The military or not. That's a common problem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As we look at kind of the trajectory for caseloads, this is a relatively new program. We look at our 2013 data as relatively new and kind of getting established in our practices and positions. For 2013, we had 68 total consults, 21 outreach contacts, 28 information and referrals contacts, with 23 soldiers case managed, and 6 suicide mitigations. Like any organization, as the leadership at as you move down in the chain of leadership learns how to use these resources, we project that the numbers are going to increase and in a nonlinear fashion, that as a given company commander, for example, learns how effective and how easy it is to make this referral, and that their soldier will then be case managed and followed up on a weekly, even biweekly basis if needed, they will continue to put soldiers in. We've had projected annual total consults of about 816. We have projected outreach contacts of 252. We expect to do 300-plus information referral contacts and manage at least 275 soldiers and do 72 suicide mitigations. When you look at kind of post-deployment, briefing, psychoeducation, the full range of things that we're doing, we expect to touch approximately 4,500 soldiers over the course of a year.
That's a huge percentage of the force.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. The ways in which we intervene, I want to leave that first bullet for a second. I want to move down. The PHAs are our annual periodic health assessments where soldiers come in by unit. They come into their armory. They come into the medical command. They're screened for medical issues. They complete surveys. They self-identify as having problems. Sometimes leaders identify them as having needs. They are seen by folks like vision and audiology. And when they screen positive on any of the screens, for behavioral health, are they taking medications, have they seen a counselor in the last year, they're going to see a provider, whether it's one of our civilian partners or one of our green suitors. They're going to be screened by us. From those periodic health assessments, they can be assigned to case management and followed. We can get records from the community and make sure that all interventions that need to happen are happening. We have unit accountability infrastructure that's being put in place where leadership is now being trained. And this speaks to the questions that came up for the previous panel members. The culture has changed pretty drastically. If you have a soldier who comes to the attention either through an active suicide event or completed suicide and a leader was not following up on signs or that the soldier needed help, the leader's going to be accountable. And there's infrastructure now to make sure that that leaders are pushing forward every soldier's needs to behavioral health. There's the serious incident report infrastructure, which was described by Colonel Lundquist. The resources that we put in soldiers' paths once they are identified include the military resources, our chaplains' corps, the military one source call line and help center, the Cascade 1-800 number, the national military and veterans 1-800 number. For our soldiers that are veterans and VA eligible, the VA community-based outpatient clinics and hospitals, the ASSIST infrastructure, resilience training, R2 training, and the sexual assault programs, which you heard described earlier. For our folks that are not either not veterans or not participating in Veterans Affairs Services, we're also connecting and working actively with TRICARE providers and their private pay providers if they have insurance or pay out of pocket. More recently, we've taken the additional step of embedding behavioral health officers in annual training events whenever we can. And this happened most recently out at Gowan Field. And it really pays a dividend. We have soldiers where we take them out of the civilian life. We train them hard for 2 to 3 weeks, and we have a very great window into how they're functioning right now. They're with their battle buddies. They're with their wingmen. And we're able to get a sense how things been. Things percolate up, and we have a behavioral health provider. They can bring them in and say, hey, we can screen you right now. We can make any referrals. And we have, in fact, from Gowan Field, identified a number of soldiers that needed services. Infrastructure. Our case management infrastructure, I can only begin to describe what a change this has been from previously, what it was like screening soldiers and then having to try and figure out, okay, we identified needs. We're going to tell the soldier, go get some care, and then maybe next year when they come back again, we'll say, how did it go? Hopefully they'll come back. We now have a variety of staff I'm going to describe in a moment that we can assign case management. We have an electronic case management tracking system where we can log in, we can look at what's been done. There's administrative information, there's medical information. We can make sure that they're getting the care they need, and they have a case manager who's making sure that it happens. We have the unit readiness inventory, which is an assessment tool that commanders can use to take the temperature of their unit. This can be done on a kind of an annual basis, or it can be done on an event-driven basis. If a particular commander feels, hey, I don't like the way things feel right now. Things feel stressed. My people look stressed, or they look fatigued. They can have their soldiers fill out. It's a 53-item anonymous inventory that gives commanders a tremendous range of feedback about how soldiers are doing. We are in the process of trying to import from the active duty military telebehavioral health infrastructure. My most recent deployment last year to Afghanistan, the active duty army is putting what looks like Skype. It's Doc in a Box, they call it. And they're putting laptops that have secured comm out at FOBs, COPs, aid stations. You know, if you have 20 providers covering southern Afghanistan, and you have a soldier pop up and, you know, on a FOB out in an area you're not in and can't get to for 4 or 5 days, you can pick up your laptop. You can go face-to-face with that soldier and decide if that soldier needs to be put on a bird. We began, Dr. Smetana and I began talking with the state surgeon recently, and with the support of the adjutant general, we're looking to start to employ that same kind of structure where if we have a soldier out in our rural half of the state, which is hardest to serve, who they can bring into an armory, we can see him face-to-face right then and decide what needs to happen. There's the performance enhancement training. Our behavioral health team recently completed up at Joint Base Lewis-McChord, which is kind of beginning to augment our skill set for working with this force. Concrete action items, and this all falls under the topic of culture change, is to know your soldiers. And the responsibility is now being pushed down even to the squad level. Know when your soldiers are stressed. Know when they're troubled. Know when their behavior looks different than it looks last drill weekend, and ask them. The idea that the and Mr. Chair, some of the questions you asked, I think, were quite prescient. There was a culture of kind of that rugged, self-determined, I don't need help. I'm going to be as strong as the soldier next to me, or as strong as the airman next to me. We're pushing back on that culture, saying we're a military that's been at war for over a decade, and there's a good chance that everybody's going to need some help at some point here. And look for it. Look for the people that might need it. And if you do need it yourself, reach out to your battle buddy. Reach out to your wingman and get the help you need. It's that inverted pyramid. Early identification makes all the difference in preventing suicides. The culture in the state of Oregon, and again, it's a top-down driven process, is so different and I think so much further ahead than most of the state National Guards that I dealt with in all three of my deployments. It moved, it brought me, I sought out the Oregon National Guard from the Air Force Reserve to come work with this agency, with this organization. It really has been a privilege. And with that, I'll turn it over to see if there are any questions, and turn it over to General Hokus.
I do have a question. Professor, you work for the federal VA. So
yes,
you're an MDAR, right?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
If you go back to the earlier slides, which you might not remember, but, I mean, Alaska National Guard's at 74%, you know, the green-yellow thing, all these metrics the military likes to throw out that some of us wonder whether the metrics are there for show or what, but Alaska National Guard was at 74%. Arizona was at 121%. Both are on the 6 o'clock news. Both of them have peers of yours and peers of the chaplain who said, hey, boss, we got a problem. Houston, there's a problem. And the boss ignored the problem. And they're now on the 6 o'clock news in these exact specific issues we're talking about. And, you know, as you said, we focused, because we're with ODVA, we have this 330,000 veterans, of we have these issues that weren't resolved, and it's hard to get them to self-identify. But the flip side of the deal, I'm seeing him pulling the mic over there, is, okay, if you're communicating as the MDAR or as the full-time psychologist to the boss saying, hey, we got a problem, and the chaplain who's full-time is communicating to the boss, hey, we have a problem, okay? The answer is, or the question really is the boss listening? And that point is important, because we see in Arizona and Alaska the boss was not listening, and we have huge social, mental problems and sexual abuse problems.
in those states, where the boss was not listening, but the guys at the bottom were communicating.
Mr. Chairman, the new Adjutant General for Arizona is Brigadier General Mick McGuire. I speak to him at least once a week for probably at least an hour. We're very fortunate that General Reese had done a great service to our state in setting up a lot of these programs, and a lot of the great personnel we have here as a result of his work. And I can only reiterate that I keep an open door policy, and this is very important to me, which is why I'm and so many people are here today. But I would tell you the fact that states such as Arizona are reaching out to us, and we do everything we can to help them work through their issues that they're facing.
Thank you. So you don't get relieved today.
Sure. Next group. Okay. Colonel Orkin and Ms. Kachaki.
Oh, yeah, Jack.
Senator Boquist and committee members, good morning. I'm Chaplain Terry Larkin. I'm the Director of the Service Member and Family Support for the Oregon National Guard. Beside me to my right is Michelle Kachowski. She's our full-time State Family Program Director. Since June of this year, I've been responsible for overseeing the diverse programs and personnel that are part of our Service Member and Family Support Directorate. For 10 years before that, I served at the National Guard Bureau. I was the Army National Guard Staff Chaplain, responsible for the oversight of some 2,000 Army National Guard chaplains, chaplain candidates, and chaplain assistants. When I was at NGB, I was very involved with both the Suicide Prevention Program and the Resiliency Program, so I bring with me, from a national perspective, the expertise of what the National Guard is doing and the Department of Army is doing to prevent and mitigate the risk for suicide. Earlier you heard from both Colonel Sunquist and General Stencil the separate but parallel programs that the Army and the Air National Guard have to mitigate the risk of suicide. In contrast, our J-9 Directorate supports all members of the National Guard, Army and Air. And many of our programs, indeed most of our programs, support all service members, Army Reserve, Air Force Reserve, Coast Guard, as well as veterans throughout our state. The Oregon National Guard is proud to be an integral part of our state and counties and local communities. As you heard from Dr. Smentana, the problem is not unique to the National Guard. It affects citizens throughout our state. It especially affects veterans within our state, veterans of all wars, of all generations. 1 in 4 suicides in the state of Oregon is by a veteran. We in the National Guard are pleased to partner with other key governmental, nonprofit, and faith-based organizations to address suicides for all veterans within the state of Oregon. Since late July, we've been meeting with key leaders from around the state to ask how we can reduce suicides for our veteran population and their families. These key leaders come from the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, the Federal Veterans Administration, the Department of Public Health, our criminal justice system, county veteran service officers, the Department of Health and Human Services, as well as several nonprofit organizations. We're developing initiatives to have each of our agencies or organizations address suicides within their respective communities. Our team meets every month, capturing and passing on the best practices of one group for another group. Cameron Smith, the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and myself were the co-chair of this group. In September, the Oregon National Guard was co-sponsored with one of those partners, the Returning Veterans Project, for a Veterans Suicide Prevention Conference in Clackamas. Over 250 of our community leaders, including some from the law enforcement community and the medical community, gathered to learn about the unique stresses upon our veterans and upon their families. This education will enable those key leaders to interface with veterans under stress to better understand and better provide the care that they need during the times of their crisis. Let's consider again some of the factors of suicide and what we and the J9 Directorate are doing to align our resources with those factors. The single most important factor that correlates with suicide ideations is relationship stress. About 2 out of 3 people who have suicide ideations report that relationship stress was one of the key factors in them considering suicide. National Guard chaplains have a program called Strong Bonds, which builds strong and healthy relationships. Chaplains teach service members and family members how to communicate more effectively, how to respect each other. We have tracks for married couples, for single service members, and for families. It is so heartwarming to hear or to read the after-action reports that talk about the impact these strong bonds have upon our personnel. A couple that, for example, mentioned the fact that after a weekend event, they were thinking before of divorcing, but they said, we'll give it one last try, and they decided to make a go of their marriage. Another soldier who reported that he was consumed with bitterness for years, and after a strong bonds event, he was able to find the courage and the strength to forgive and to be released from that bitterness. A study has been done by the University of Denver for couples who complete the Prepare and Enrich Marriage Track. And they studied the couples that complete that for 5 years afterwards. They discovered not only is there an increased level of marital satisfaction, but a decreased level of personal stress for 5 years after a weekend event. This year, the National Guard will sponsor 9 events and many more half-day or full-day events, reaching over 700 different service or family members with relationship education. Second factor we've talked about is that's tied to suicide ideation is financial stress. As one of you have mentioned, service members are not only unemployed, they're underemployed and feel incredible angst because of that, often leading to marital fights or depression. National Guard has 3 programs that address service members facing financial stress. The first of these is the Joint Transition Assistance Program. It's a team of 15 people scattered around the state whose primary job is to help service members and families find employment. In the last fiscal year, this team helped 520 service members find new employment. The goal this year is 800 new hires. By way of contrast, our total force structure is something just over 8,000. That's 10% of our force structure that we're going to try to find not only new jobs, but better jobs. The JTAP team works closely with our employment support of the Guard and the Reserve to sponsor job fairs. And just this last week, the Memorial Coliseum in Portland, there was an event that had some 460 service members and veterans that attended. Many of them walked away with new jobs or better jobs. Because of the close connection with service members, we ensure that all these JTAP personnel are trained in suicide intervention and have had some practical experience. This last year, the JTAP team intervened with 34 service members who were thinking about taking their lives. Second initiative we have to address this financial stress is that we're partnering with Dr. Leslie Hammer from Portland State University on a project called SERVE. It stands for Study of Employment Retention of Veterans. Dr. Hammer has received a $5 million DOD grant to develop a training program to enable civilian employers to better understand how to support returning veterans. Dr. Hammer and her team will be interviewing 500 National Guard service members and their civilian supervisors to better understand the working relationship and better develop this training for mutual support. The last factor in addressing employment stress has been mentioned before. Oregon has the services of Russ McCallman, a certified financial planner. Russ provides individual financial counseling on topics like how to get out of debt, how to manage your credit cards, and for some of us, how to prepare for retirement. He also provides group education to National Guard families. Russ meets with 1,000 service members or family members each year to provide his financial counseling. Another factor with suicide is financial stress. Oregon has 10 family assistance specialists scattered around the state. These FASAs are skilled at listening and then pointing people to the right resources to meet their needs. All of our FASAs also receive this suicide intervention training. Now, interestingly, our studies have shown that for service members who report suicide ideations, over half had previously gone to talk to a family assistance specialist before the suicide ideation. Last year, our family assistance specialist had over 35,000 interventions and contacts with either a service member or a family member. We also have 3 child and youth coordinators that also mitigate the risk of suicide. While we've been focusing mostly on service member suicides, their children are also at risk. Our team of 3 child and youth coordinators are trained to spot the warning signs of suicide among the youth of our National Guard service members. As you've also heard, we have 2 other military and family life consultants who are clinical social workers, skilled and experienced. So let me just footstop this if I can. We realize that suicide is just not a service member issue. It also affects their spouses, their children, their grandchildren. The rate of suicide among our military teens in particular is quite alarming. Over the next few weeks, we'll develop means to report, to track, and to provide support to all family members of National Guard personnel who have suicide ideation or attempts. As we've discussed, many of our service member and family support, including our family assistance specialists and child and youth coordinators, have received specialized training in knowing how to intervene and how to spot the warning signs of suicide. The last significant factor correlated in
Senator Olson has a question.
Excuse me.
You were talking, the financial side really interests me. The E7 and E9 and below, I certainly don't make the wages that the officers do. Is there a correlation between the suicide on the officer side as to the enlisted side predicated on financing? Because when our younger troops go off to war, they don't make a lot of money. And it's got to be put a terrible strain, especially our National Guard folks, got to put a terrible strain on the family finances. And, to come back with that on their head, plus what they've done, do you see a correlation that do the officer, they make more, they always made more? Is there less of a burden on them than there is on the enlisted?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, yes, there's a definite correlation between a higher rate of suicide among our enlisted soldiers than our officers. In part, our enlisted soldiers are much younger, and the greatest risk, as you've heard, is between those 19 to 24-year-olds. We're not sure if it's a financial correlation or if it's simply an age correlation or rank correlation, but that's something we've talked about. And anecdotally, yes, there is a direct tie between the financial stress, our junior enlisted experience, and their possibly considering suicide.
Yeah, follow up. Do you ever do any studies as to the burden that's put on the junior enlisted financially when they leave? I mean, they might have a good job in being a construction operator or whatever, and they go back in the military, and their pay certainly is decreased from what they were making. Do you ever do any studies as to how that impacts the family overall, and when the guy comes back or the lady comes back to their regular job again? I mean, they're behind on everything probably, and that's got to be a burden to try to catch up. Do you ever do any studies to see, or are there also any grants available to help these guys catch back up in their financing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, absolutely. That's something that the Department of Army and Air Force have been looking at. What is the correlation between service members at risk for financial stress, especially those who have returned from deployment, and what it is that we can do to be able to help them manage. So that's why we're trying to align these resources to help them find jobs, not just entry-level jobs, but good jobs, and our financial counselor that helps them manage their personal budget and their credit cards. So we're trying to take a holistic approach. But yes, there have been academic studies done that look specifically at the financial stress and the possible tie to suicides.
One more follow-up on that, because with our rural communities, and as the chair has said, you know, most of our National Guard are out in the rural area. They're compounds and stuff. And since we do not have active military posts in our state, so we don't have the PXs and the luxury of reduced costs for groceries, etc. That's got to be. When a soldier leaves, that's got to be terrible on the family, because the income level drops precipitously, and they still have to maintain their level of life. They have to pay their bills, they have to pay their insurance and buy groceries. And they don't have that relatively cheap commissary to go to buy stuff at a larger, you know, bulk, cheaper rate. And so to me that would be, I mean, that's got to be something that's got to be looked at, especially in our state.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson is a chaplain. I've talked to junior enlisted soldiers and heard the angst in their voices and how much they want to provide for their families and feel like sometimes they can't despite their best effort and attempts. So I concur wholeheartedly. That's a definite stressor for our people. And that's why we're trying to put these resources to be able to help them take care of those needs. But even with our resources, it still is a huge problem for us.
Does the active follow-up, does the active military have anything available for we states that don't have military compounds to help them financially, or are we just kind of on our own?
Sir, Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, most of our resources are federally given to us, but they're aligned within the state of Oregon. We choose to align our resources as we see fit. There isn't a program that I know of that the federal government provides that kind of a relief to our airmen and soldiers.
We're on the Titanic, Senator Olson.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, the one thing that we do have within the Army is there's the Army Emergency Relief Fund and the Air Force Relief Fund. So when soldiers are deployed, they are eligible for those. And then we have also a similar type fund in Oregon that we try and utilize those resources as we can to help soldiers through those difficult times.
Can I ask one question of the general? General, I just would like to ask you, because it's been a long time since I was in the military, and I know I only made $2 a day, and now as a senator I make $65, so I'm really in it. What does a typical standard E5 make? I know an E1 is extremely low, but what would an E5 make? Because it seems like most of the guys that are deployed are either Spec 4 specialists or E5s.
Sir, I would have to, Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I would have to look at the specific detail on that, because it depends on the years in service. Also, when they deploy, there's additional benefits they're eligible for, such as combat pay. Housing allowance, of course, which they may not receive on a regular basis. So if you don't mind, sir, I can get that exact data out to give you a much better number. But they have been... There are programs to help try and compensate that as best they can through additional pay benefits that they receive while deployed.
Follow-up. So when they deploy, they get would they then be eligible for off-base housing because they don't have a base to live on, whereas if they're in the National Guard themselves, they don't get any special housing allowance?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, yes. They once they're in a deployed status, they're on active orders, and so at that time they are... The variable housing allowance or basic allowance for housing, they become eligible for, and that's part of their pay compensation.
And one other question then. When they are deployed, do we as a state tax them on this increased income? Or do they get a...
No, actually, both
break.
The state and the federal have breaks for combat deployment.
Because, you know, it would be ludicrous to give them more money and then take it away in taxes.
Sure.
Though, since only the minority is present at the podium, the Oregon breaks are not as gracious as other states.
Good, okay. We can work on that.
Chaplain, proceed.
The last significant factor correlated with National Guard suicides is shame and guilt. Service members want to, they need to feel forgiven. Chaplains are skilled at helping service members deal with shame and guilt. Chaplains also teach what we call moral leadership training, which instills in our service members a sense of respect for others and a need to build up our colleagues. While bullying or harassment may be common in civilian life, chaplains are the moral gatekeepers for commanders and staff to ensure a healthy work environment and to help service members who are victims of trauma inside and outside the workplace. When people are in crisis, they often turn to clergy for counsel and support. This is true for our National Guard service members and families as well. Chaplains help counsel service members under stress, including service members with suicide ideations. Chaplains also provide spiritual support to service members and families after completed suicides. While most chaplains are not skilled or trained to do sustained mental health work like our colleagues before, chaplains are gatekeepers, trained in suicide intervention and counseling for intervention and referral. If I could just make a comment as a chaplain for our previous discussion, do some of our junior enlisted and officers in their late teens and 20s sometimes have moral lapses, sometimes have times of mental and emotional instability, and are they capable of changing to be able to develop more emotional stability? I believe in my experience, suicide is often a crisis that only lasts for a day or a week or a month. But often we're able to help people through that window of crisis, and so they can become more emotionally and mentally and spiritually stable and not be at risk in the future. In other words, can and do people change? Absolutely. And I've experienced that on a regular basis as a chaplain. Here's a description of our J9 staff. Our staff is strategically placed around the state where they are accessible to our geographically dispersed service member and family population. Because of our upcoming deployment in the summer of 2014, our directorate has actually received an increase in funding this year. One of the few government organizations that's actually had increased funding, enabling us to hire 8 additional personnel to provide support. In summary, the Service Member and Family Support Directorate is part of a comprehensive effort within the Oregon National Guard to address and to work to prevent suicide within the Oregon military population. Mr. Chair, questions?
Questions, Mayors? Okay, I have a question for you.
Okay.
And you're full-time. You came from Guard Bureau, right?
Yes, sir.
And so you're probably familiar with the chaplains in the state of Alaska.
I've visited Alaska on 2 occasions and familiar with the state chaplain and some of their chaplains, at least, sir.
Yeah, they've been on the 6 o'clock news a lot lately. And it's part of the resilience program. So you obviously know the Adjutant General from being at Guard Bureau.
Yes,
so,
Mr. Chair.
So, and in the state of Alaska, what transpired is, Houston, we have a problem, and the combo at the other end wasn't working. And so the resilience program didn't work real well up there. Some of them are in lawsuits. I mean, I think you're familiar with the issues in Alaska up there. The new Adjutant General, who you've known before, does he have an open-door policy? And do you, if someone comes to you with a resilience issue, whether suicide or sexual harassment or rape or anything along that line, do you feel you can walk into his office and say, hey, boss, we need to do something?
Mr. Chair, I can speak about my relationship with the state chaplain up till a year ago. I've been back in the state of Oregon for a year, and I know that up until that time, the state chaplain had some frustrations about senior leadership. Although they said they officially had an open-door policy, he felt like they weren't as sympathetic or sensitive as he would have wanted them to be. And that varies from state to state. Adjutant generals are incredibly busy people, and it's understandable why they might not want to give a state chaplain as much time as he might want to have on their calendar. I can say with our present Adjutant General, he is very sympathetic for these concerns, and I've had no problem whenever I've asked to see our present Adjutant General and having time to be able to address the concerns that I have as both a service member and family support director, as well as a chaplain, when it comes to these kind of issues.
Thank you.
What about the past Adjutant General?
I think the past is past.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I was here so briefly in serving as the Service Member and Family Support Director. It was only 1 month under the previous Adjutant General, so I didn't really have time to be able to develop that relationship.
The only reason I ask that question is there a foundation of a resilience problem that we have to work on, or was there an openness that
allows us to continue on as we were and get the job done. That was, I guess, where I was aimed in my question.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, just my reference point is our deployment in 2009 and 2010 as the 41st Brigade, we went downrange. One of the things I personally tried to instill across the brigade is to double the number of chaplains because of the value they provided to our soldiers downrange. And when you look at the year-long mobilization and deployment process, having those chaplains resident not only in the formations but in the convoys with our soldiers every day, they were there when we needed them the most. And I would tell you, one of the key factors that I really tried to accomplish, we were able to do because of our chaplains, is that not having any suicides during our entire mobilization and deployment process. So I would say I've tried as much as possible to realize and demonstrate as a leader the importance of chaplains and what they, the role that they provide and value to our soldiers.
I just want to make it clear for the record that I wasn't trying to dig up dirt, just trying to see if we had some bumps we needed to smooth out from the past, or if the road is smooth and well paved now, you know, let's continue on. But that was my goal, was to see if there was any inherent problems in the past, and obviously there wasn't. So I'm that's pretty good. So thank you.
One last panel.
Mr. Chair, I'll be followed by Dr. Julie Marshall.
We're going to have to speed it up here a little bit, sir.
Yes, Mr. Chair, this one should be very brief.
She's been here. She can talk fast. We know that.
So, good morning, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Julie Marshall. I'm a licensed psychologist in the state of Oregon, and I'm currently responsible for the overall operations of Cascade Centers, as well as the director of the Oregon Military Assistance Program. So, I didn't want to change. I got it. Sorry. So our contract with the Guard to provide the military helpline is a federally funded program, and I'd like to speak to you today about Cascade Centers and the quality and breadth of the services we provide to the military assistance line. A little bit about us. We are headquartered in Portland, Oregon, and we primarily serve groups that are located in the Pacific Northwest. But they have employees that are spread throughout the United States. So we provide crisis line services and suicide prevention services and assistance services nationwide. We serve over 350 different public and private organizations that total about 437,000 covered lives. We're not new to this. We've had 39 years of experience providing high-quality suicide prevention lines and assistance programs. We've been an active part of the Oregon community and have developed strong relationships and partnerships that have really enabled us to provide a comprehensive, holistic approach to crisis intervention. We have expertise serving veterans and their families that goes beyond the last 2 years that we've worked with the Oregon Guard. We have provided confidential services to military and personnel throughout our history. We've worked with the military department, the Oregon Military Department, over the last 25 years, as well as other organizations through federal occupational health, naval undersea warfare, naval bases, as well as working closely with our private sector employees and working with the vets that they have on staff with them. And in addition, it's been very important to us that we reach out into the community to serve the vets that are in our Oregon community. So we have donated staff time, hundreds of hours throughout the year, working with organizations such as Veteran Transition Corps, Portland Veteran Stand Down, Point in Time Homeless Count, Boots to Roots, the Meals to Vets programs. In addition, we provide pro bono face-to-face counseling services to vets and their families through the Returning Veterans Project. So a little bit about our call center. We annually receive more than 130,000 calls annually. To give you a makeup of our calls, out of all our counseling calls, about 9% of those callers report having suicidal ideation, so suicidal thoughts. 2% of those of the all overall calls call with a concrete plan of how they intend to carry out that suicide. And 99% of our calls we have de-escalated. So what that means, there's a small percentage, less than 1%, where we've facilitated a rescue in the community to help prevent that suicide. So Cascade Centers is accredited by the American Association of Suicidology. We were accredited in 2012, which means that we went through their rigorous process. They examined our operations from top to bottom. They had an examiner on site spending hours with us, interviewing our staff, observing our procedures, watching us deliver services. And we were found to meet all the criteria established by this association and are approved as a quality crisis intervention program. So they were able to see that we based our program and our training on evidence-based protocols. And most recently, we've been approved as a contracted affiliate, so we went through their process for the National Suicide Prevention Line. So I anticipate within the next month, we will complete their setup process and start taking calls in Oregon for that national line. So a little bit about our staff, which is something that the training of our staff, we have highly qualified and trained staff, which is something that sets our call center apart. All Cascade counselors are master's level above in counseling and are trained to not only provide crisis suicide intervention, but because of their clinical background and training, their advanced skills enable them to go on beyond that just crisis intervention and provide a high level of clinical care to the callers. So, you know, as Dr. Smentana mentioned, mental health diagnoses plays a large part in people's risk for suicide. The risk for suicide in people with major depression is about 20 times higher. Other diagnoses, PTSD, anxiety, has shown to increase the risk of suicide. So it's really important to be able to identify and diagnose those clinical issues that are going on, not only when someone calls in crisis, to be able to identify those other diagnoses and intervene, but also if they call us and they're not in crisis, to be able to diagnose and get them to the right level of care in a real preventative model in that way. To illustrate that, a recent caller that we had, a vet called in reporting significant suicidal ideation. He reported that he had been diagnosed with PTSD. He'd been deployed twice, once to Iraq, once to Afghanistan. And as the counselor started to talk to him, it became evident he was currently, at the time of the call, experiencing some severe symptoms of PTSD, some hypervigilance, so very anxious, having some intrusive memories that were crashing in on him from his deployments. And so it was a very clinically complex situation. The counselor had to contain those PTSD symptoms while also addressing the suicidal ideation, which is what happened. So the counselor worked with him, de-escalated the suicidal ideation, and provided interventions to get the PTSD symptoms under control, and stayed on the phone with him about 2 hours until he was stable and safe. And in the course of this, the counselor was able to identify that he also suffered from some clinical depression. He reported his wife was leaving him, was what initiated that initial crisis that he called in for. He was a student, and he was about to drop out because he was having difficulty focusing in his class. So over the course of several calls, because we needed to do some follow-up calls to make sure he maintained that stability and did not reach a crisis point, we got him connected with individual counseling to address his PTSD and depression and contain that suicidal ideation. In the course of that face-to-face counseling, that counselor wanted him to get a medication evaluation, so we connected him with those resources. And then also his wife agreed to do marital counseling, so we connected him to those resources. And so this is a good example of a case that it was really essential that the counselor had the skills to assess and intervene at all those levels, not just the crisis intervention, but that complete picture, and it's why we staff our phones with master's level counselors. We have staff veterans, counselors on staff that are available 24 hours a day, and this is important because, as you know, when vets call in, many times they want to speak to a vet. They think that that's who's going to understand them and that's who they're comfortable speaking with, and we want to make sure that that's available to them. And all our staff, you know, as I said, they have to have that basics in master's and counseling. But in addition, we provide them an additional 156 hours of training that equals about 4 weeks of full-time training where they receive extensive review of crisis intervention, assessing suicidology, safety plan, intervention, rescue procedures, all grounded in evidence-based techniques. And then also within that was the military training that they get as well from our vets who are on staff, which is a very important piece. And our training's ongoing. We have weekly staffings with all our counselors to provide clinical supervision, but review cases, best practices, those types of things. In fact, the American Association of Suicidology was very impressed with our training regime. So just quickly about our quality assurance. It's very important to us and has been to have a process of quality control. This is where technology has been our friend in not only enabling us to be able to provide services in increasingly different ways, but able to track the quality of those services. So we have internal guidelines and performance goals. We're able to track all our calls. We can look at spikes and call loads to make sure that we're staffed appropriately. And we can look at, for instance, one of the most important measures is our average time to answer. So all our calls are answered by a live voice within 30 seconds. Most calls are answered within 1 to 2 rings, which is 10 to 12 seconds. Excuse me, which is very important. There's no automated telephone system. There's no queue that people are placed in or voicemail. When service members call in, they reach a live voice.
It's not in Pakistan either, right?
Nope, Portland, Oregon. So, and we are resource experts. I mean, 90% of the calls that we get are service members calling us because they're lost in the system and sometimes feeling hopelessly lost. And so we need to make sure we know the resources that are available and get them to those resources. So we have a really sophisticated, comprehensive database of resources that we've developed for service members. We do primary source verification on those continuously, which means we're working with those resources in the community. We know, you know, what ones are available and what resources they have at the time, because that changes too in terms of funding. And it's particularly important, as we've talked about, you know, there are many rural areas in Oregon, and vets can get very isolated, as well as the resources can get sparser in those areas. So it's real important for us to have those relationships and knowledge of those resources that are available. Confidential and anonymous, which is very important. I don't think I mentioned about 60% of our military callers wish to remain anonymous. So that's an important part for them to be able to do that. And we follow up with every call. So when we give somebody a resource, we want to make sure we follow up with them to make sure that they receive that resource and they don't fall through the cracks. One call into us averages about 5 calls and resources and things that we're doing both with that member and the resources that we're referring them to. And then finally, just quickly about our services. I talked mainly about our crisis intervention with the preventative model and our master's level counselors and resource experts. But we also have other avenues to provide service. So technology, again, more and more people are comfortable, especially the younger generation, with texting. And so they may call, they can text us instead of call us and pick up the phone. And I think not only is it a technology people are more comfortable with, again, it gives that anonymity. They might be willing to text before they're willing to pick up the phone call, as well as they can do online chat. So if they want to do it from their computer versus their smartphone or their phone, they can do that. And we also have online video counseling available. So again, it's like a Skype, but it's not Skype. It's a HIPAA-compliant server where they could actually have a video session if they wanted to talk to the counselor and see the counselor through the video. We have an interactive internet site that has thousands of resources, military and civilian, streaming videos, articles on financial, legal, behavioral health issues. And our newest piece, which is in development, it should be ready in about 5 months, is an online resiliency program, which is an interactive app or a desktop program if people want to access it that way, which teaches the 5 fundamentals of resilience. And through really, it's designed to be more of an engaging and interactive process. So it really fits with kind of our holistic preventative model. So we're excited about that piece as well.
Sarah Olson, you had a question?
I did. When you have military personnel call in to your center, do you pass that information on to the military department so they're aware of it also, or do you keep it just compartmentalized inside your facility?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, we keep information confidential. So we are separate, and that's one of the pieces that's important for callers, is to know that they can call us and have a confidential place to talk. And I think it makes service members more willing to talk, that knowing that the chain of command may not be involved. Legally, if there was a dangerousness issue, we may have to then intervene and involve people to keep people safe, but in general, it's separate in a confidential place that they can talk and get services they need.
Follow-up?
please?
Yeah, the only, and I understand the need for that, but the concern is that now the military department doesn't know the problems they might really have.
Right. If there was a safety issue or they were in a position where there was a safety issue involved, then we may have to work with them to breach that confidentiality. But other than that, it is a confidential process.
Mm-hmm. Does anybody but me see the, do we see a problem? I see a problem. You guys don't know how many people are really out there.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, sir, we do face that issue. And when we go through our mobilization process, we found that as well. Sometimes where our active duty medical records did not have access to VA records. And I know there are widespread efforts across the military to try and resolve and find that balance between, you know, folks that want to remain anonymous, but also balancing the needs of the organization and the welfare and safety of those they work with. So that is, sir, that is an ongoing process we're trying to work through.
Question on that. If say hypothetically, a National Guard soldier called the hotline, right? And of course, it's confidential. It's so on and so forth. But in theory, under HIPAA, could you not refer them to one of the clinical psychologists in the Guard?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, and that is a resource that we use most definitely.
All right. Mm-hmm. All right.
And work closely with them.
All right. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, that completes our presentation on suicide prevention. I want to thank you for this opportunity because, as you saw, this is extremely important to us, and we're trying to do everything and anything that we can to reduce or end suicides within our organization. That completes our briefing, so, sir, unless you have any other questions for any of our panel members or myself.
Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you.
I'd just like to make a comment. Thank you for your support to what you do for our soldiers, and thank you for this in-depth compilation of what's out there and what's available. It's important to know and maybe perhaps ferret out some of these little problems that might be there. But this was great.
And I greatly appreciate it because the thing we have, FY14, $7.6 million out there in front, but at some point, I guess we need a warning order to the legislature when the feds start whacking the budget to say, hey, ODVA Director Cameron back there, you're going to inherit this problem here very shortly because, you know, the funding stream is going around, and it's really at the legislature. Unfortunately, you have so many hearings, a lot of good things happening out there, but the legislature tends to focus on the negativities of, like, what's the problem? How are we addressing the problem when, in fact, you know, multiple organizations, both ODVA and the military department, are doing great things out there that a lot of people don't know about, but you generally don't get hearings and updates and information on all the super great things. It's like, okay, what's the issue and what's the liability? And, you know, in this case, we have a lot of good people trying to figure out a solution that no one's figured out since April 19th, 1775. And so if we're finally getting a grasp of this in the last 10 or 12 years of how are we going to address this issue, we probably are making progress.
Yes, sir.
And we appreciate all the time and effort you guys have put into this.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Unfortunately, I'll need to depart prior to the resilient response and the
CP. You need to go to work and do earn a living. Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Thank you again for
this
opportunity.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah?
I'd like to go to a swearing-in ceremony. Can we take a brief break for that? Because Senator Mona Sanderson would like to go also.
I am going to. It's at the chair's discretion.
Okay. We're going to stand at ease for about 10 minutes or so and readjust our schedule.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Back into session here. Go ahead and have a seat there, Dr. Ashford. I apologize because if you don't know, Senator Jackie Dingfelter resigned and she was replaced by Representative Dembro, and they're doing the swearing in. This is a building where you multitask, and he's doing the swearing, and I think she's doing the in, and so therefore, you know, several of the members are gone. So if you would please, you want to summarize it real quick, counsel, and then...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is the update on Senate Bill 33 that got bumped from the top of the agenda. The Task Force on Implementation of Oregon Resilience Plan, and just to remind you, Mr. Chair, there were several hearings during the 2013 regular session from the folks who participated in preparation of the report that is called the Oregon Resilience Plan in both of the Veterans Committees, and Senate Bill 33 had a friendly relating to clause, and the creation of a task force was inserted into that bill, a 17-member task force. Appointments were made. They had their first meeting, I believe, on November 4th, so it's relatively recent. Governor's office has appointed Dr. Ashford, who's making an appearance to introduce himself today, as the chair of that task force. So they've just gotten underway.
And with the title of Kearney Professor of Engineering and Head of School of Civil and Construction Engineering, can you put that on one business card?
That is small print.
Small print, right. Well, everything in this building is small print. Okay, Doctor, you want to give us a brief, introduce yourself and give us a brief update?
Sure. So my name is Scott Ashford. I'm the Kearney Professor of Engineering at Oregon State University and head of their School of Civil and Construction Engineering. I'm chair of the committee. My vice chair is Jeff Rubin, who is with the Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. Our first meeting was December 4th, and we've scheduled monthly meetings through September 2014, and our report is due in October, that following month. I served on the advisory panel in development of the Oregon Resilience Plan. My background is in earthquake engineering. I do research with earthquake preparedness, particularly related to liquefaction and bridge performance, that sort of thing. I understand quite well the threat that Oregon faces with the Cascadia subduction zone. I'm often requested to participate in post-earthquake investigations by the National Science Foundation. I had the opportunity to visit Chile, New Zealand, and Japan following their earthquakes over the last two or three years, and just earlier this year, I had the opportunity to follow up on the recovery and visit these countries 2 and 3 years after the earthquakes. I think my goal, at least as chair of the task force, is to work with my members and to develop recommendations for implementation of the Oregon Resilience Plan. What we want to do is make sure that it is usable, the recommendations, that they're implementable, and that we can keep the momentum moving that we have in the development of the plan over the last couple of years. And the end result is making Oregon more resilient.
Well, we appreciate that, and I think if we go back to 2005 and the original discussions with Senator Verger when they had this committee and we kind of started down the direction of, are we ready, we had a whole list of possible scenarios, some of them uglier than others, mm-hmm. I think as Mr. Stuckey knows, and ironically enough, it's just the tsunami that we settle on. If you could survive the tsunami, you could probably, and you're prepared for the tsunami, you could be prepared for all the rest of these other less than desirable events that are out there. And so that is one of the resilient issues to keep in mind, is there are little deviants there, as you know, earthquakes and Mount St. Helens and foreigners who don't like us and things mm-hmm. like that kind of go into it. And the one thing that we've heard when the presentation was made on the plan that I would just echo for the record for you to keep in mind is the business community issue of, if you recognize a problem and then you start to fix the problem and it happens too early, you get sued. And multiple times, multiple businesses testified before this committee saying that, hey, look, we're reluctant to participate or reluctant to release our resilience plans and participate in the process, because if we say we know this building is bad or this doesn't going to work and we're not prepared for that, then the ambulance chasing lawyers will come after us. And that has not been resolved. And I think that's going to require at some point a piece of legislation that says if they participate in the process and they identify these things, that there's a hold harmless of some sort,
mm-hmm.
which I'm certain will take the Judiciary Committee months of negotiating with the Oregon Travel Association.
But that's what I've seen in New Zealand, for example. Once the lawyers get involved with the recovery efforts, things tend to slow down quite a bit.
Right, right. There are solutions for that, but again, we appreciate the update on it, and we appreciate all the work you guys are doing.
All right, thank you.
And I apologize for the committee. The committee is so weak at this point. It is not resilient, and we have no depth. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And now we're going to talk about cows. And cows, if you don't know, aren't in Tillamook. They are cells on wheels. And we know a little bit about them, but we've actually not heard from Verizon on this issue. And do we have a copy of the slides?
We do.
Okay.
Not a hard copy.
Okay, but we can email copies of the slides out. All right. Mr. Martwick.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Anthony Martwick. I'm Area Director of National Public Safety Strategy for Verizon Enterprise Solutions. It's a great privilege to represent Verizon and share with you our commitment and support to public safety. What I'm going to do is walk you through a building block of a technology update, because this has a part of the business continuity and disaster recovery programs that we have at Verizon Wireless. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about some of the key technology applications that first responders are using, and then we'll go into some specific examples of our disaster recovery program and how we engineer our network. So in our company credo, we have we run to crisis. We, our employees from our retail stores out to our field sales force, live and breathe this credo that we support the community of which we operate in. Our Verizon LTE network, it covers 500 markets, 95% of the total population. One of the maps up here on the left-hand side is our 3G network with our LTE network overlaid on that. By the end of this year, our 4G LTE long-term evolution network should mirror our 3G footprint nationally. We have a great depth of spectrum available. Right now, we are getting into the stages of LTE Advanced, which is going to add capacity because we see a great deal of demand on smartphone usage and tablet that we're moving to additional depth in our spectrum. This is our coverage for the state of Oregon. And when it comes to disaster recovery and first responder support, our coverage in the state is deep and wide and rich throughout the state. This is a map that shows 4G, LTE, and our 3G EVDO. So there's two networks there. Our LTE coverage for just standing by itself is well built out along the I-5 corridor and key areas within the state. So when we look at, and I'm going to start framing up public safety and how we view public safety as it relates to business continuity and disaster recovery and our responses to natural disasters. We look at mobility, machine-to-machine, which are sensors and monitoring for seismic, earthquake, health and air quality, cloud IT support, moving applications into the cloud for redundancy and disaster recovery, advanced communication for encryption and security and interoperability, and then the networks, multiple networks. We have our Verizon Wireless networks and our Verizon Enterprise networks, and we combine those because in today's first responder environment, it is a mobile device tied to an application end-to-end, and we're committed to that. And then security, having leading-edge security solutions for cybersecurity and device security. So one of the evolutions that are going on within public safety is FirstNet, which is the first responder network. And this was developed and passed under the middle class tax relief of 2012. And it's establishing a nationwide LTE public safety dedicated network. And Verizon helps support the advocacy of the additional spectrum for public safety to build out a new LTE fourth generation network. And we sit right next to that spectrum that FirstNet has on a national basis, and they're referred to as band 14 and Verizon is band 13. So we sit right next door. And where this plays a key part of our commitment to the public safety is that when you look at the future and how everything is unraveling towards this new innovation, we have LMRP25 networks, commercial LTE networks, that public safety FirstNet network that's going to be built, Wi-Fi networks, and then satellite mobile deployables, and that is where we're going to be talking about some cows and colts and mobile deployables. But this is really the ecosystem that public safety is going to be utilizing during times of disaster and event mitigation and response. There are these types of technologies for wireless. So one of the things that we have committed to in our LTE innovation centers, and we have two of them, one in Waltham, Massachusetts, and one in San Francisco, we've put resources to focus on public safety applications, technology, and development. And out of those innovation centers, and these are a couple of the new innovations that have come out of that, in the grid there's a routers and modems that are specifically designed to operate on that FirstNet public safety national network, but also operate on our network, so we can give a nice, good transition and support public safety in a redundant manner for our wireless network. And we're working with handset manufacturers and tablets to help drive that innovation to reduce some of the infrastructure on that development. Some of the innovative components that are on the right-hand side, the upper left is a GoldenEye. It's a virtual reality device that works across our network for firefighters, and it allows them to see through smoke and see details of floor plans as they arrive. Medical devices, from heart cardiac monitoring that automatically call 911 if there's an observation, mobile healthcare deployables for medical tents in case of a disaster. Your doctors can, you know, be deployed in the field and have communications back to their facilities via these medical equipment. So a lot of innovation.
I have a question. So the new public safety net that's being created, obviously there's the federal oversight, but do the states have to buy into it? How do the...
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Each state, the governors of each state have the oversight of the FirstNet spectrum and the initiative. For the state of Washington, Steve Noel is your state point of contact for that.
And in the state of Oregon, is Oregon's participating in this?
At this point, they've received their SLGP grant funds to do outreach, and I'm not in a position to speak on the behalf of the state of Oregon, but we have been, you know, talking with them, sharing our initiatives and our support for whichever decision that they go to.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So just to kind of move from that piece to some of the technologies that are utilized across the Verizon network for first responders, this is an example of the next generation push-to-talk that also integrates with land mobile radio systems. So we're able to bridge cellular, traditional commercial, into the land mobile radio networks. So the officers, the firefighters that have those land mobile radios can interop and talk to somebody on a cell phone. Where that's an advantage is if an individual is outside of that land mobile radio network, they can talk back and forth and inter exchange. The other is that they can now see, with the advance of the wireless LTE, you can actually see presence. You can see where your assets are on the ground, and you can talk to them directly by just pushing their name. And you can see, you can, if you look at this, Dave Thompson. If I click that individual, I can see who it is. I push talk, I talk to him. Or if I don't push them, everybody in green, I can talk to them all. So there's a lot of presence and geomapping and geospatial presence now coming with these applications for first responder capabilities. The other is incident command, real-time whiteboarding, being able to show up on scene and be able to communicate and move and real-time whiteboard to from an incident commander to the field operators that are responding to that. So real-time collaboration. So it's breaking down those barriers that from a paper and tablet to real-time communications. Another example of some of the technologies that we've deployed is sensor applications, mitigating rock falls, and having sensors that are wirelessly used across the network to be able to monitor, in this case, the large rock over the highway. This little device on the small right manages the GPS movement and the vibrations of that rock, and if they see any large-scale movement, they can then determine what their risk level is if there's going to be a rock slide. So we're getting ahead of some of these known or areas of disasters that could be happening. Some of the other examples of first responder type technologies, canine search and rescue. We actually just finished up development for actually increasing the health and well-being of canine officers, sworn dogs, on their embedded biometrics chipset. Across the country, canines have they've lost because of heat exhaustion. They've passed because of stress and anxiety. We now have embedded a chipset under the dog and monitor that across the wireless network, so the operator can do that. So there's a lot of innovation around search and rescue and dogs. Quick deploys. Wide scale of quick deployable technologies, from simple MiFi commercial devices all the way up to quick deploy satellite systems to provide complete communications off grid and that interop with our LTE network as well as land mobile radio. And then a variety of sensors capabilities, from asset managing, knowing where your assets are being moved around from a state emergency management level. If you're moving resources from Red Cross from one location to another, being able to track that pallet quickly on the fly. You can throw a small device on it and track it, and you can see exactly where that device is. And then chemical sensors and biosensors. So big depth of applications around situational awareness. So let's get into the business continuity disaster recovery and how we approach this on a national scale. We have two arms. We have the Verizon Wireless Crisis Response Team, and this is where this service and support program is cows, which are cell on wheels, cell on light trucks, repeaters on trailers. These are our mobile assets, and I'll show a couple of these here in a little bit. But this is where we deploy these assets during a disaster or a large-scale event or a pre-planned event, like the NATO GA. Super Bowl, large sporting events, where we take a look at increasing or ensuring that we have capacity in a given area during a time of an event. We also provide charging stations and actually phone calls and devices for like a fire department in a forest fire, being able to make calls to their family, recharge their devices, and we deploy these assets, and we'll share that in a little bit. And then we have our Verizon Wireless Business Continuity Team, and this is actually the wireline side, because now we've got this blending of fiber wired networks and wireless networks, that we also have our wireline group that is a part of our disaster team. So when we look at our crisis management structure and training, we focus on our mission-critical functions, systems, and support customers, the IT systems, provisioning, call center routing, self-service tools, functional teams, our tech support, our warehouse operations. Our entire company, by region, gets activated from a support structure. People really volunteer towards internally making sure that we have enough resources to these dedicated teams. And then we invest in our reliability. We have geographically diverse locations, teams, and systems. Each of our regional presidents across the country are the lead for our crisis response activity within their region. So here in the Pacific Northwest, it's Oregon, Washington, Alaska, and that is handled by the regional president, and that's what kicks off all of the resources across all of our channels. So we have 45 crisis management teams across the country. It's led by senior leadership. It's a conduit for customer needs during emergencies. These services and these programs are provided to the government in the response at no charge. We do not charge for these deployables. It's part of our commitment to maintain our network in a disaster response in an event as it goes down. Here's a visual of our four areas and, you know, the 45 crisis management teams. We have over 148 switches, thousands of cell sites, and two national network operation centers. So everything's redundant. We have a switch here in Hillsboro, Oregon, for the state of Oregon. Its sister switch and backup switch is in Redmond, Washington. And then it also fails over to another facility as well, if anything should happen to those facilities. But they're very hardened facilities, and I'll be sharing with you those elements here in a moment. The network operation centers, they're manned 24/7/365. They're at the national level. They can see the entire national network from the facilities to the cell site to the switches to the performance. So there, we have those two national NOCs. Then at the regional level, they're also being managed at the regional level on the system performance of the network. And these are the mobile switching facilities. They're self-sustainable, multiple battery backup, on-site diesel engines and generators, diverse circuit paths, so we use multiple wireline circuits going in and out of these facilities. We design and build and manage these facilities at Verizon. They're fully hardened, bulletproof glass, non-discrete areas, and are able to sustain an entire state network operating on its battery and generator backup.
And probably unlike government, you actually have fuel for the generators?
Absolutely, and that brings up we have priority fuel contracts, okay. And I was going to kind of share with you in our Sandy response, we work very closely with FEMA, and in some instances, you know, they may try to take the fuel, and we work jointly with FEMA to make sure that the fuel going to our generators are applied, because it provides infrastructure for the citizenry to call 911, as well as the first responders to be able to operate on that cellular network and those mobile cows as they deploy.
I raise that because the committee's had testimony before where we had government entities, not the state, but we had government entities here in Oregon where they had the backup generators, but they had 2 hours worth of fuel and no other fuel. So
right.
It did.
Right. And another example is I was part of the emergency management team from the vendor community in the Green River Dam mitigation up in Renton, Washington, where we looked 8 months ahead knowing that there would be a risk to that dam breaking, and we worked with them to actually plan out what would be the impact to our network during that time, as well as pre-staging fuel and looking at what that mitigation from our perspective would be. So we get very involved in tabletop exercises as well. So typical cell site, again, battery, generators, so there's a lot going into cell sites. Here's actually a picture of a cell on light truck. They're fully functional cell sites that can operate independent and be lit up to add capacity or bring in coverage where needed. We have our own fleet of portable generators, cell on wheels, which are the cows, which are a little bit larger, full flatbed trailers that we bring in, and then we have mobile generators that we can also bring into our facilities if needed as well.
Industry question.
Sure.
So a typical cell tower in the coast range, you have the structure there, it's got a backup generator. Obviously, you can turn it on automated, or if something fails, the generator automatically starts. What's the typical life of, you know, does it have fuel to run for 10 hours, 24 hours?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's correct. The generators will automatically kick in. If there's a fuel generator on site, that will kick in. Some, you know, codes don't allow fuel generators to be on there, but there's battery backup. Mm-hmm. So what we typically say as far as battery backup, about 8 hours, enough for a technician to get deployed, for assets to get deployed to ensure the support. The fuel generator is just dependent on the size of the fuel tank and the generator. And again, that 8 hour mark, enough to sustain for our network teams to get out to that site and manage the site and the location.
Chair Olson, you have a question?
I do. You know, one of the things we talk about all the time is the big tsunami that's going to come, the big earthquake. And I've seen your technology before. I went over at the Grand. We had some stuff. The question I have is, if this big tsunami comes, it's going to inundate the entire West Coast. What is your capacity to supply technology to the coastline of Alaska, Washington, Oregon, and California? Do you have enough technology, enough cows, et cetera, to put out there to be able to cover this area? Because we're going to have to airlift them in, probably.
Correct. Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Olson. These are very unique disaster-type situations which require that involvement and planning. I've had similar planning sessions with the state of Hawaii on tsunami and how would we get assets from the mainland to the islands and then to the outer islands. So logistics and planning is where we really can sit down and do those tabletop exercise and help facilitate looking at what is our response and what are our capabilities, what would the state of Oregon potentially need.
I heard the response to Sandy, Hurricane Sandy, and you guys did an exceptional job. You had technology there right away. But
yes,
if this fault occurs, if we have this earthquake, I mean, we're talking thousands of miles, and I was just wondering, you know, you've got Washington and Oregon, and Alaska is your president here for emergency disasters. I mean, do you have like 25 cows available to each state, or is there only four for the entire area? Or?
No, so they would organize the fleet that's on a national basis. So there's a fleet in the state of Washington, Idaho, so regionally there's a good sized fleet, but as we did with Sandy, we started pulling assets and resources from other regions into those locations, especially in Katrina as well. And in, you know, some of these known forecasted hurricane type situations, we pre-stage, you know, they're you know, making sure that they're out of the hit zone and then move it in.
Well,
tsunamis, earthquakes are a little bit more unpredictable, and that's where we work very, very closely at a national level with FEMA to in those large national disasters.
But I guess the question where I'm trying to get to is what kind of capacity do you have? Because the earthquake is going to be instantaneous, it's going to be long term, and we're going to have devastation for months and probably even years. So the question I ask you is do you have enough capacity to? I mean, I guess the question would be, how long would it take you? What?
Does the industry as a whole?
Yeah, does the industry have the capacity, and how long will it take you to mobilize to be able to allow us to put communications into these areas where we desperately need it?
Right. So, Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, a lot from the capacity, we have the assets. It's a matter of getting them into the area. Is there fiber? Is the fiber still infrastructure still available? Those are the types of questions of going into an unknown, because we're a first kind of acting on the first responder as well. Those unknowns, what is that infrastructure going to be like, is dependent on how the availability of restoration is. So as we deploy, there's satellite, microwave, and then fiber connections for these cell and light wheels and trucks. As far as the assets and resources, those we pull in from the region, nationally, from this group to be able to push into that.
And one last short question. Have you ever, or do you plan to set up with OEM a disaster program, not a program, but practice run? to see if you guys can enter work together and your capabilities will match?
We would invite that, Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson. We'd totally invite that opportunity. We are very involved with a number of large states, very closely with the state emergency management on coordinating either mobile communication centers like the state mobile centers and doing a rally as well, you know, making sure that we're coordinating with their efforts and their initiatives, very close with the state of California on CAL FIRE and organization with the state there on organizing our response mechanisms. Same with the state of New York.
Are you aware of any of the industry members, yourselves, AT&T, the group as the industry as a whole, participating in the Oregon Resilience Plan?
I can get that answer. I personally am not involved in that. But again, we would invite that opportunity to contribute as a
private sector. I don't believe in our committee we have any communications in there.
Yeah.
Because what I'd like to see is a practice run.
Yeah,
you know, absolutely. You've got a cow. Can we pick it up and can we move it to the coast? And can you get up and running within 12 hours so that we can have communications on the coast?
Yeah, and Senator Olson, bringing that back to, you know, really it's working with the National Guards as well, because they're going to be doing a lot of logistics, and having that communication and that open logistical dialogue with our networking folks is a good conversation.
We just wait for the rain. We can do it in Vernonia for real.
Yeah.
I will say, when I worked on the 911 task force and came up with some bills there, this is a Verizon phone, and I used it many times as a sample to what technology can do and why aren't we doing it.
Yeah.
I have AT&T and it doesn't work.
Okay. Oh, that's right.
So, Mr. Chairman, I'll continue on. So, response assets, just outside of the network assets, we have community outreach. So we're not only supporting first responders, but the community and the citizenry, because they're you know, needing resources as well. Command and control vehicles, response assets. We actually know that in some locations we're showing up and there's no hotels for our network folks to stay in. So we bring our trailers and comfort vehicles with us. We have facilities for our network teams to be able to sleep in, water, filtration, and all those necessities that our network engineers need to deploy in an area that's been completely devastated.
Well, I would make a, Mr. Chair, I'd make a point of that if this happens, which we're talking about, you're not going to get that stuff over there because there won't be any roads to get it there. So we need to figure out an air or sea capability to move your stuff in to be able to have your people there. I mean, that's something you ought to look at.
Right, and one of our policies, too, is that we won't send any of our network first responder type individuals into harm's way. So we look to the guidance of, is it safe to move assets into an area? And we take the guidance from, you know, the government that's in charge of that incident. So
we are the government. That's what we're worried about.
Yeah. So, you know, another key element is, you know, mobile hazmat. We have a hazmat team that is able, certified, and is able to enter into zones that have been, you know, rated as hazardous material. And this actually proved very well in Sandy, being able to get in ahead of the situation. With those certifications, we can get into areas and begin restoration and assessment into our facilities on the wireline side. The other example is the mobile command vehicles. So we do roll these. We rolled it at Moore, Oklahoma, and the sheriff set up his command center in our facility, and we gave him a command operational infrastructure to respond to the situation on the ground. So some of the emergency support needs that we help educate from a government field sales operations is making sure that the public safety stakeholders are aware of wireless priority service, that there is a wireless emergency alerting infrastructure with WEA and CMOS, and helping agencies and states get established to be able to do a reverse alert across all carrier networks, being that reverse 911 type. You need to get this area cleared. You want to send out an alert, and this is, you know, how amber alerts are shot across. And then enhanced 911. and then law enforcement resource team. That the ALERT program is for trying to find individuals that are missing, exigent situations. We have a whole group dedicated to that. And then part of our education outreach too is we our sales teams provide these small wallet size cards to, you know, chiefs of police, fire chiefs, the individuals that are making those calls to be able to get these assets rolling. So we help educate and make sure we reinforce our support mechanisms for public safety. Here's a couple examples of, you know, the Sandy response. Again, we rolled our big 40-foot trailers and multiple cows on wheels and trailers in that response. We have Humvees that will deploy and provide services to, you know, the citizens, you know, helping, you know, get phones from one store to the next or out and deployed to those public safety entities. Floods, again, in the Fargo floods, you know, time-tested on, you know, moving in a flooded environment, deploying assets to bring the network back up on, you know, in areas that have been completely devastated. So again, our teams, when they look at, you know, what is a regional type event, tsunami, earthquake here in Oregon, you know, then we can sit there and look at what is your expectations on, you know, roads. What are you doing to be able to provide access, and can we tap into that? Mm-hmm. So it's that true partnership. This is the Moore, Oklahoma, having, you know, one of the sites hit. It was operational within 24 hours, and we have very hardened facilities. This was a direct hit, but it took us, you know, 24 hours to get everything back up and operational. We were on scene within 8. Wildfires, again, Arizona, Colorado, Southern California, very involved in providing services and cow cell on wheels out into very remote areas and providing that cell coverage and infrastructure. Specifically on Oregon, here's how we've deployed in 2013, this year alone, 7 Verizon Crisis Response Team support, a lot with the National Forest Service and U.S. Forest Service on the wildfires. In the years past, going back to 2010, 12 times that we've provided cell phones, additional devices, deployed a cell on wheel to an event that's being requested from the agency here just within the state of Oregon. Currently, we're responding to, up in Washington, the San Juan Island outage. We've deployed a variety of cell phones to the first responders and the citizens to be able to make calls, 911 calls, because we are getting phone calls off of the island because we're doing a microwave backhaul, and so we have coverage on the island during the event. But we deployed phones at no charge to the government, to the county, and the sheriff to be able to have cellular coverage during the event.
Is the island still phoneless up there now, or have they got it partly recovered?
From the last news update that I got, Mr. Chairman, I think they were still working on it as of this earlier this week.
Because what most people don't realize is when it went down, ATM machines, all communications went down.
Everything.
So even stores that would normally use take your ATM to be able to charge food to eat couldn't take your ATM, so it
exactly.
Created an absolute crisis, just like happened in Coos Bay here 3 yeah. years ago.
Exactly. So proactive support, again, provide, you know, we do a lot of pre-planning for presidential inauguration, sporting events, you know, G8, NATO, and, you know, coming back to your request, Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, you know, we are a partner. We would invite the opportunity to help contribute to the disaster plan and share with you our mitigation and our capabilities and really know each other's responses. So proactive steps, increase capacity and network, coordinate efforts with local and state. We, our employees, again, from our retail, all the way up to our leadership, are very committed to our crisis response. We really hold that proudly on our ability to deliver. So we do work very closely with DHS, FEMA, the White House, exercises with federal, state, and local. I just was participating in Northern California Urban Shield in the Bay Area, and we 5 years in a row being able to participate in those types of anti-terrorism and infrastructure type scenarios. We get a good insight as to what is going on. We also get to deploy and test new technologies. A lot of these innovations, getting it in the hands of the first responders to test it out before it actually occurs, because you don't want to be learning a new technology or a new phone or tablet or device when the disaster is occurring. We also work very closely with, you know, our utilities counterparts, because power is important to us as well as it is to them. So a lot of, you know, our regional network teams are very connected to, you know, the utilities to make sure that we're working in conjunction, you know. So a little bit about, you know, our additional public safety support programs. We are a national sponsor of the FBI National Academy, National Law Enforcement Office Memorial. We have a, under our Verizon Foundation, Verizon provides financial aid for any sworn officer that falls in the line of duty, and they receive a check from us via the FBI NAA within 24 hours of the notification of that fallen officer.
Did you respond to the case in Oregon City?
Yes.
Thank you.
Hopeline, one of our corporate charitable sponsorships, and this, you know, rallies the entire company around, is domestic violence and prevention. So we have Hopeline, where old phones that our customers turn in or our employees turn in get refurbished and resent out to domestic violence shelters for individuals checking into those facilities to start anew, have phone and communications to be able to communicate to their family and friends as they go through their healing process. Those are two major processes that we're proud of and continue to support. We are also a couple military and veteran. We're very recognized for our initiatives around supporting the military. Being ex-Navy and the military myself, I can attest to the culture within our company supporting not only the best for vets, employers, but military spouses and friendly employer and most valuable employer for military. We're very committed to ensuring that when a veteran comes knocking on our door, that we're open.
And thank you for your service.
Thank you. So, in summary, talk to us, you know, before the emergency. I've been involved in numerous tabletops here in the Northwest, from anti-terrorism to natural disaster planning and mitigation. And again, we're very open to being a good partner in helping assess and analyze what those capabilities and what those needs will be in a time of natural disaster or man-made event.
Are you aware of anybody in the industry participating in tabletops or exercises here in Oregon?
I am not in the state of Oregon, no. I could talk in a more suitable setting on some exercises that are going on, but...
Right.
Do you have Mr. Stuckey's card? Because we need to do this.
See, we don't trust FEMA as you figured out here, right? But the problem with FEMA is that in a tsunami type event is they're, as you pointed out, up there in Washington, so they can't get here any better than anybody else can. And so the question is you're really on your own to start with, regardless of what happens. And
correct.
And the biggest problem you have is not knowing what you're knowing. There's a joke here, because you heard me mention Vernonia, because there's people in this room that know this. Vernonia has a major flood about every 10 years, and we always talk about how good our communication is, and we've built redundancy, and virtually every time, it's about three times as this happened, we've had to load a ham radio operator up on a National Guard helicopter, fly them to Vernonia and set up a ham radio, because nothing has ever worked.
Exactly.
So
the golden hour, Mr. Chairman, that's that's the key is the golden hour.
Yeah.
And you know, we have a variety of technologies, and we have our limitations as to does anybody on the response, but we have a whole entire operation and proven crisis response team that gets into some pretty hairy stuff, and they're very adaptable. But, you know, we can help in that planning on what our capabilities would be in facilitating response.
And I would assume each member of the industry probably has a little piece of something that they can put in the pie if the whole industry is invited to the table.
Exactly.
Because, you know, obviously it doesn't do you any good to go do this, and AT&T does it, and everybody, you know, it's like, okay, in this particular case, if there's a tsunami, there's going to be more than enough opportunity for everybody to participate.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it goes beyond. It's our commitment to be able to respond to not only our citizens and the public the literal public safety to get that going. It's not about the sales. It's about our commitment to our society to be able to help facilitate, because cell phones have become such an integral part of everybody's daily lives. So that focus on the response is key.
You might have answered this. I'm sorry.
Right.
You might have answered this question earlier before I got here, and I apologize for being gone. But do you have the capability to use everybody's signal, AT&T, Verizon, Quest, all of these guys? Or is it just Verizon signals that you can send?
Correct. Each carrier is responsible for their own spectrum.
So if everybody has a Verizon phone, they should be okay. So do we need to mandate that? Or?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, we also deploy, you know, in these types of events, additional phones. So if you do have a mayor or a county council member that does not have a phone, and we've deployed a cell on wheels, we're deploying those handsets as well that can be given to those decision makers and those leaders to be able to
well,
operate.
I said that in jest, but the problem would be that if you deployed and our emergency people weren't on that cell system, then we're still in trouble. And so that's why an exercise would be appropriate to find out what capabilities we have and what we don't have.
Absolutely. Senator Olson, I've sat in a number of mobile command units from the state level to the county level doing assessments on what their capabilities are, as well as looking at the future as FirstNet is, you know, rolled out nationally. That is one of their key pillars within the FirstNet model is mobile deployables, that first responder, that state agency, you know, has their own cell on wheels or has additional technology that can be totally operating in a bubble completely off-grid. You know, and having those communications available as well. So it's really going back to that one slide that shows here are all, you know, LMR, the commercial networks, the FirstNet network, the Wi-Fi, the satellite, all of that in time of a total disaster is, you know, everybody comes together. Because that's what it's about.
And I would assume that when you're doing some of these things with FEMA and Table Talk, which is a large regional deal, is, you know, your peers from the other companies are there, and everybody, there are multiple cellular companies that are involved and participate in this, and who can do this slice and who can do that slice and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
But the best way to do it is to plan and do an exercise beforehand rather than waiting for the 100-foot wall.
Every year in the state of Hawaii, Mr. Chairman, is they have an annual exercise every June. And it's hurricane and tsunami, and they invite their private and public partners. I've sat in the same room out there with the Oregon National Guard, California National Guard, who take cycles on supporting the islands on their logistical needs as well.
Okay.
No question. Thank you.
Greatly appreciate it.
So thank you very much.
And you're in Washington, right?
Yeah, I'm in Seattle, and I report back into our headquarters in Basking Ridge and Laurel.
Do we have this gentleman's contact information?
Yeah, we do.
Excellent.
I could give you a wallet card just so you have the number at all times if you need us.
Actually, you can give Mr. Stuckey your wallet card.
Okay. Give him several.
I'm going to ask questions here shortly.
Yeah. It's been a pleasure, gentlemen.
I appreciate
it very much. Nice presentation.
Thank you again for coming. Thank you for your service. And with that, colleagues, we're going to close the... Do you have anything else on it, right? No, we're going to close the Senate Interim Committee on Veterans Emergency Preparedness. Thank you. The Senate Interim Committee on Veterans Emergency Preparedness. Thank you.